news jobs. They're old, grumpy, and are pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
Hello and welcome to episode 87 of the Carpcast. I'm getting a bit of the nosebleed, Mark. We've been every week now for ages.
Yeah, we're getting a bit of a regularity going. It's because we're not going fishing. That's what it is. Because we're both nesting our old age. We sat behind the window with a nice warm radiator in between.
Why don't we do what everybody else does in the winter when they're bored and just cause trouble on the internet?
Because we're not dicks.
That's the reason. as usual, the winter boredom setting in. The usual culprits are out there causing trouble. And I've actually started to see a bit of backlash against them now. People just realise their MO, that they're just absolute snakes in the grass. So it's nice to see. Obviously, I stay well out of it. Sure, we've both been victim of some of this as well. But
I really just don't bother looking now. I'm just over it. And I don't know if you saw a video I shared yesterday of some Scottish dude did his Facebook Live as he went for a swim in a Scottish loch. I think he was in the Cairngorms National Park.
Yeah.
So he went for a swim in it. And that's what I look on the internet for, just amusing content like that. You know, if there's you muppets, I carry on being a muppet. I don't care. I'm going to look for the funny stuff and entertaining stuff because...
I stopped reading things about myself before Facebook even started in the days of Fishing Warehouse forum.
Those were the days, weren't they? That was some fun.
Yeah, there was two main forums. If you're a northerner, you were... Well, there was another one, wasn't there? NWFF or something. Yeah. Which was Northwest Fishing Forum, wasn't it? It was Fishing Warehouse and the CMEX, which was later called RMC site. I mean, back in the day, before the trolls realised they had a voice, you would get the top people posting on them. Terry Hearn used to post under the name Tenchi, which was his nickname down at Yateley in the early days. All the top anglers, to be honest. Dave Lane used to post regularly. I mean, I shared a post. Tom at Cartfeed made a post on our page about the history of the Sonningbrook Eye, and it reminded me to go look back at an old thread about the eye where they were discussing it going missing, and everybody was involved on that. People like Steve Alcott, Dave Lane, Terry Hearn, all telling their own stories about that lake, and it's one of the best threads I've ever seen on a forum. So it's well worth going back and reading. I did share it in one of our pages not too long back in the comments.
I remember seeing that, and I also remember seeing it when it was originally up there, and you know, you'd get home or you'd finish what you were doing and you'd like check in again and there'd be another dozen posts, and it was compulsive reading and interesting, and it wasn't all the like you say, the trolls, but another forum. I remember you had NCFF.
That was Northern Monkeys, wasn't it?
No, there was Northern Carp Fishing Forum. Yeah. Whereas Adam Snowden and a couple of mates did it. That was the same. You know, you have people like Dave Morrill, popped up on there every now and then as under the name of Nut Rabbit. That was from Nutribait.
Yeah.
We was at the time, and Crowy on there every now and then, and quite a few others, and even Bill Cottam as well. So there's quite a few interesting conversations. But
and what you'll notice is none of them people get involved on Facebook. Terry Hearn doesn't have a profile, certainly not under his own name. He stopped posting on the forum as soon as the trolls moved in. Are we fortunate to have lived through an era pre-trolls and then seen the emergence of trolls to the point of, there's Facebook groups now set up that only for the purpose of negativity and trolling. They call it a laugh, but it's just plain negative bullying.
Let's be honest, it is bullying. I was going to come round to that word.
Yeah, it's pure bullying. They say it's a laugh. It might be a laugh for some sad, pathetic people, but everybody else sees it as bullying. But like I say, I stopped getting offended by that after catching the Colmere fish. If you remember the debates, I used to get involved. I couldn't help myself. I'd get involved back in the Fishing Warehouse days, and you soon learn that you're just feeding the trolls. Why should I be bothered about what people you wouldn't piss on if they're on fire? their opinion of you. Why would you ever be bothered about people that did not affect your life in any way? Why would you be bothered about their opinion? And you soon get thick skin, and I just don't even look now. Just don't even look. And that was before Facebook, so...
Yeah.
Every now and again, I mean, I do like a good debate. Every now and again, I'll get stuck in.
The thing is, with a debate, there's one thing is a debate, you know, an intelligent discussion is one thing where you've got people putting, you know, opposing views, but, you know, keeping it clean, keeping it civil. But there's a fine line between that and someone reading it wrong and joining in and just being a dick.
Yes, as we know, the internet's given lots of toxic people a voice, people that wouldn't, you know, some of these people I've met in real life and they're fine, but on the internet they just decide they can say stuff that they'd get a punch straight on the jaw. Talking of a punch straight on the jaw, by the way, I had a road rage incident on, is it Friday?
Somebody punched you?
Tried to break my finger.
Really?
Yeah, I had him pinned down with an hand around his throat at the time. He was on the deck in the pouring rain on the side of a busy motorway near Stoke. Not motorway, A road. We had to come off the motorway because the motorway was shut. I'm in the wrong lane. So we're following the sat nav in an area we don't know, diverted off the motorway. And I have caught up a guy by being in the wrong lane. Fair enough. A guy behind... not the guy that I've cut up, just the guy behind me has decided he's the cut-up police. And he's tried overtaking me. It's drizzling. It's horrible. It's just getting dark, right on the edge of getting dark. And there's traffic coming the other way. It's like really busy because obviously it's heavy traffic from the motorway diversion. And this guy, I hadn't even seen him. The first thing I know about him is when he's come from behind and hit the front of my van. Like on the front right hand side of my van as I'm driving. I'm like, what the fuck? Anyway, he's decided he's a cut up police and has done what road rage people do, you know, where they try and overtake you and force their way in. But what's happened is there's a bloody island in the middle of the road. So he's overtook, got stranded on the wrong side of the road. There's a concrete island in the centre of the road and he's in shit creek. So either it's the car coming the other way, it's the island, or it's me. So chose me. We've pulled up in front of drove off, pulled up 50 yards down the road, got out of the car, and he's screaming at me. He's like, caught up, you shouldn't be doing this. I'm like, yeah, I caught up the guy in front of you, not you. You deliberately caused an accident. And he went, yeah, I did, yeah, fucking did. What are you gonna do about it? It's like, well, the red thing happened. I don't really know, it's a bit of a blur how it started, but I remember he's got me and he's pinned me up against his van. He's in a transporter. He's pinned me up against his van and then I felt the fight go into the floor and I was like, there's no way I'm getting on the bottom here.
Was it a good takedown?
I remember my judo I did for years as a kid. Yeah, I put me, as we were going down the floor, put me right leg round his right hip and threw him down. I've landed on top of him, my hand round his throat. And he's grabbed hold of my little finger. I've got him pinned down. He's grabbed hold of my little finger and, like, snapped it, basically. It's bright.
Ow, that's against the rules, little small digit manipulation.
Yeah, it's green and black now, like my hand and all my little finger. Reedy's with us. He's in the van at this point. I can picture him now. He's like, oh, no. Classic's out there scrapping on in the gutter. Then he's come out and I've got this guy pinned down and the guy's screaming, get him off me. And this guy wasn't particularly big or young, you know.
Was there any ground and pound involved at this point?
No, just something inside me stopped me just doing that. Like, I should have, when he snapped my finger, I should have just planted him in the face, because I was there with my fist ready to smash his face in. But it was like, I don't know, maybe my inner sociological upbringing stopped me from doing it, especially as I'm sure there were people driving past videoing it, because I imagine the scene, two cars pulled up on the curb on a busy road and I'm in side control and kneeling on top of this guy's chest with my hand around his throat pinning him down, and you know, my right arm sort of raised in a threatening manner to smash his face in, and which I didn't do. And then Reedy's come out and Reedy's like, I'm not letting you up till you calm down. are you going to calm down? I saying that to this guy. Well, I've just got him pinned. Anyway, then the guy that I actually cut up has obviously seen us both stop, decided to come stick his nose in, going, I saw it all. She's going to this other guy. I saw it all. He was in the wrong lane. He cut me up. I went, yeah, I cut you up, not him. He's just deliberately caused an accident, then boasted about it, and then attacked me. And he's all the time, he's taking pictures of my registration plate. I'm an off-duty policeman, I said. I said, all right, arrest him for assault, please. He's like, oh, well, I didn't see that. I went, are you going to take any pictures of his van? He went, you caused it if this was in a court. I was like, yeah, and as a police officer, you only take one side of the evidence, do you, and then just present that to the court, not the other side. He's clearly not a copper, just one of them fucking dickless Jobsworth that wanted to stick his nose in and giving it, oh, I'm an off-duty police officer. Oh, well, you're doing a really good job at taking control of the situation, pal. But clearly not an off-duty police officer. And then this other guy just went, he went inside the guy's sort of cabin. This guy, I can see him trying to drive off. And this guy, it says he's a copper, that's not, has gone up there. Yeah. And he's gone, leave it, mate, just leave it. And this guy just drove off. So now he's left the scene of an accident without providing his details, which is an offence. So I said to the copper, what are you going to do about him leaving the scene of an accident without providing his details? You know that's against the law, don't you? And he's like, well, it's your responsibility to take it. And how am I supposed to take it? The guy's just attacked me and got in his van and drove off. Like, how am I supposed to take his detail? Clearly, the guy hasn't got a clue. So, yeah. I'm now pissed with him. Anyway, I've just told him to get stuffed and got in a van and drove off. Me and Reedy, after about 5 minutes of shock, we're laughing our heads off.
Was it much damage to your motor?
No, it's actually, it didn't dent it. They're pretty tough, them vans. It didn't dent the front. He smashed the mirror. And the indicator is probably a couple hundred quid to replace that, because it's one with the indicator and all the stuff built in, all the electrics, but fairly minor. I mean, I was in the wrong, you know, I caused the cut-up, but it doesn't give you the right to go, you know, because somebody's in the wrong, go and deliberately drive into them. Or it doesn't give you the right to get in a road rage either. You can be annoyed, like, but if you're going to go and cause an accident or blow your lid because something you don't like's happened, I mean, that's anger management issues. So I was pretty calm all the way through it, even though he's just driven into me. Until he grabbed me. Until he grabbed me, and then it wasn't going to end well for him after that.
Yeah, that's made quite an interesting tale for the podcast. I haven't got on tangent. Well, that's quite fun, but it's also reminded me of, I'm ashamed to say, several incidents when I was taxi driving.
Yeah.
Sure, I'll tell you about one. I've pulled up outside the Dana Motel in Doncaster. We've got an account to pick the staff up, but you know, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night, and there's two lads have tried flagging me down. Obviously, I'm not stopping for them, all my doors are locked, so they come over, they try getting in the car, they're locked. I pull my window down, and I says, sorry, mate, I'm picking staff up here, bud. And one of these lads was, yeah, fair enough, no worries, but his mate started mouthing off. You know, he's giving it all the, you know, long-haired effing this, effing that. And he stood there, like, you know, the front of my car, and he's looking like he's about to boot my car, which is what I was concerned about. So I'm thinking, I'm not having this. His mate's trying to pull him away a bit. But anyway, I kind of unfolded myself out of the car. So in the 6.5 foot of Viking lookalike unfolding in front of you, and this kid wasn't exactly a giant. He took a backward step straight over the curb and fell flat on his ass. Which I said to his manager, just pick him up and leave, which he did. But I did have another thing not so long ago at the end of my own street. I've got to the end of the street on the way to work, and I've pulled out, and literally a paper boy, I say paper boy, he looked like he was in his 30s at least, doing a paper round, has just bounced off the front of my car on his bike.
Great.
So, I mean, I've come to a stop and he's hit me while I've been stopped. So he's there mouthing off. Now I've put the window down, I'm mouthing off. But it's quite a busy road in front, and I'm thinking, if he carries on, I'm going to get out and we're going to have a wrestle here. But I also thought, there's lots of people here on the way to work, and all they're going to see is a great big hairy bloke getting out of his car and battering a paper boy. So I thought better of it, went to work.
There's got two more stories you just reminded me of. One was
we're going to have to title this podcast Road Rage.
One was I was watching one of them YouTube videos, you know, when somebody shares it and it goes a bit viral, of it was a scene, it was some sort of motorbiker fighting with this long-haired guy in a ponytail, looks a bit like you. Anyway, I'm watching it, and I thought, I know that guy. It wasn't you, but it was a guy that I play poker with, Danny Hook. Play poker with him every week, like in the local casino. Yeah, it was him. And I don't know what's happened, but he's driving, and he's big. He's at least as tall as you, 6'5", probably.
Yeah.
Long-haired. And he's restraining this guy who wants to fight him. And this guy, this motorbiker, keeps coming back at Danny, and there's obviously traffic everywhere. And he's going, do yourself a favour, mate. Go away. This guy comes back at him. Every time he grabs him, restrains him, puts him to the floor, restrains him, lets him up, and the guy comes back at him again. It must happen about 5 times. This is a pretty funny video. I'm like, sure, I know that guy. Anyway, it was in Danny Hook. It was in Preston Town Centre. Pretty funny. But one a bit more fishing. Well, it happened wild fishing. It was not me. It was my mate Dave, who we talk about on the podcast quite a bit. Yeah, him and his pal who lives in Tenerife. They'd gone over to fish. You know, the Lake Gomera in that little island called La Gomera.
Where Kevin Allen went to, isn't it?
That's right. Gomera. Yeah, yeah, the really deep place. Frank Warwick's been there quite a bit as well. He reckons there's some absolute monsters living in the deep, bigger than any fish he's ever seen. But Dave and his mate, who lives over there, they've got the ferry over and gone there. They've hired a car, driven over. They're fishing. It's dark at night, and they've just heard this almighty crash, like really loud noise. Anyway, it's on. There's loads of it's pretty steep hills and mountainous around there. As a biker come flying down the hill at super speed, and not seen the car parked in the lay-by, and just planted the car at high speed, gone through the window of the car, seriously injured. I think they airlifted him in the end. Imagine that, just being sat on the lake hearing a smash, and someone's just planted himself at high speed into your motor on the bike. Yeah, the guy was mashed up, apparently. I don't mean he died, but he, as I said, it was a serious job. So they're now stranded on there because they've gone off the island of Tenerife with the car. The hire company didn't want to do anything about the motor, which is now trashed. And they're stranded on this lake with no motor.
Worst places to be.
Yeah, I guess. It was a bit of a disaster trip all round, I think, that one. But, weird thing. You got any off-the-wall stories that have happened to you while you're fishing, then do let us know.
Story time.
Do you know what? As things happen, as we go, there's two more that you've been telling them that just popped into my head, both involving Thortmarsh Power Station Pond.
Yeah.
The first one is when they were blowing up a couple of the stacks. There was a couple of us fishing. We'd gone there fishing so we can see the stacks bit blown up. And, you know, the coppers have come around. They've got this exclusion zone, which I was parked in. They've got this great big riot van. You know, the park light in the front of where my car was on the road. They've come down. We've seen him. It's all civil. It's like, yeah, we'll move it. No problem. And he reversed straight into my car with his riot van.
Great.
But the other one, the same lake, there's a fellow who used to run the fishing on there. Richard Ford, he was called, or just Ginner for obvious reasons. Mm. I'd run there one night, and the road at the side of it had a bit of a kink, and there was the occasional crash there, and this evening there was. We both walked up to the fishing car park, which there is just over the other side, and there's people stood around. We could see there was no one, you know, seriously injured. They just had a crash, so they're sorting themselves out. We got back to his bit. Well, they weren't bivvies, and it was little brollies back in the Argos Ratchet bedchair days, and we'd gone to sleep. So I spoke to Ginner in the morning. You know, I've caught nothing. And I said, have you had out? And he says, yeah, I've had a nice brace of mirrors. I said, why didn't you get us for pictures? He went round the back of his bed chair. At the time, he was driving an old Cavalier. The car that had crashed and been left there was a Cavalier, the same colour of his. He'd been over and nicked the wing mirrors off it.
Do you remember Elstow and the car went over the...
Oh, and the magic carpet swim. Yeah, that was Mitch Webb.
Yeah.
That swim that year, everyone was who fished it was bivvying up at the top of the bank, kind of on the ledge,
yeah,
because the swim was flooded. As the year went on, the level dropped a bit and people started bivvying up down the bottom. Mitch was bivvied up down the bottom where a car was dumped over the bank and landed nose first, where people had been bivvying up while he was literally just underneath it.
That's crazy.
That was a lucky escape, but there was some crazy things happened on Elstow. I remember there was one time there was just me on the lake. I don't think I've told this story on the podcast before, but I'm on decoy or low point, and you remember the pipe swim?
Yeah.
Like a lot of that lake, mega deep margins. A car's pulled up behind it. Three people have got out. And they're in some, it might have been Muslim, it might not have been, but some sort of ceremonial dress, you know, like white bed sheets.
Yeah.
And they were doing some sort of baptism because this one fellow was dressed something different. They threw him in and then had to get in themselves to rescue him back out.
They threw him in from the pipe.
Pretty much, yeah. And you know how deep and slippy those clay margins were? Well, he kind of like, you know, got in and then was dunked. And then he couldn't get his foot in and couldn't get out.
I bet. So, yeah, wouldn't like to go in Elstow. It was so deep. And the margins are pretty much full of brambles and trees and God knows what.
Remember when I caught the import the first time? You know, that got snagged up in the pads. And I was literally, I've got the net, you've got my rod. I'm like at full stretch, the water's up to my waist. I lost my footing on the clay and I just slipped. I went straight down the ledge and head under. Yeah. Next thing I know, I've kind of like got up and the fish has freed itself and it's splashing around right at my waist and the net's still at full stretch.
That's my fish, really, wasn't it?
It was a joint effort, but I did catch it again, so I'm claiming it.
Yeah, it's. A few stories. One of my favourite stories, especially for being in a funny old situation, was on one of the very early Carpcast extras, and it was Ronnie De Groot. If you haven't listened to the first series of the Carpcast extras, Ronnie De Groot is a very well-known European angler. He's from Belgium. He's held the Belgian record. He doesn't really do much big fish fishing, but he's one of the best fishing minds I've ever spoke to. He's really, really good, especially when it comes to big fish, but he's also a really good storyteller. He's very entertaining, but he told us a story about fishing. It was a famous stretch of what's the canal called in Belgium?
Is it Kempish?
Kempish Canal, that's right.
Yeah.
And there was a section down there which held the record, and it fished well in the winter because it had a power station pumping hot water into it for all the coolants and stuff. And it was around the time, it might have been the Iraq War, so probably 80s would it have been, the first Iraq War, I can't remember what year that was in. But obviously the power stations were a site that were being protected because of potential, you know, retaliation type, you know, terrorist attacks or whatever it is. Basically, anywhere that was important to the infrastructure of the countries that were out there fighting that had to be protected just in case people tried to attack back, basically.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they're fishing down there in the middle of the night, and there's army patrolling around the power station. And you weren't allowed to be there at night anyway, so it's not like they knew there was anglers there. So you imagine some like 17, 18 year old young what do we call them, cadets? I don't know what they are, but you know, like a sort of young army guys, sort of people they put on these jobs, who's probably not expecting to meet anybody in the dark and is possibly going to panic if they do. I'm sure he said, I can't remember the full story now, it's a couple of years since I recorded it. I only got back and listened to it. But I think if your buzzer goes off or anything, and obviously it's going to alert them, it's definitely quiet. You're not supposed to be there. And if you get a bite or a few beeps or something while one of these guys is patrolling past, and I think that's what happened. I think they could hear these guys at the top of the bank behind them. Now, obviously, if they hear a noise down there, something that's not supposed to be there, they're going to shoot first and ask questions later.
Yeah.
So, obviously, Ronnie tells the story way better than I could. But, yeah, I always remember thinking, that is not a situation you want to be in. You're kind of not supposed to be there anyway. There's a war going on. You got young squaddies walking about with machine guns and you alert them when you're not supposed to be there. It's possibly going to have to be dodging bullets. But
yeah, I can imagine. So there's little bleepy things and red LEDs down there.
Yeah, it's not a good situation. But yeah, shall we finish with a story time for now?
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. We've not even had any beer either.
No, we haven't. We haven't. Yeah,
just check. Caffeine.
I've not even had caffeine. I had a brew, and then maybe I've got a chili buzz. I ate Friday's curry while we were warming up. But yeah, bang the old curry in the microwave. It was pretty nice. Anything on the net, Mark? Have you spotted anything this week?
One or two bits and bobs. There's one thing that did pique my interest. Having interest in deep waters, this was a story of a capture of some carp from Bundy. It was on Carp Feed.
Yes.
It's on the net in association with carpfeed.com. So it's definitely true.
Anyway, I'm just going to get it up now, but didn't the fella catch like 6 or 7 fish from around 30-odd foot?
You've had a winter ticket on Bundy's, haven't you? So why don't you fill us in the general details of Bundy's?
It's not a massive lake. I'm gonna guess around between 8 and 10 acres, but it's a clay pit, and it is deep, as in very deep. Deepest I caught from there was from a swim called the RAF, which is in the deep end, and it is around somewhere between 50 and 60 foot.
Wow!
You know, you cast out and you put the kettle on, make a brew, have a pee, see what's for tea, and then the lead hits bottom.
Yeah.
It really is a surreal sort of fishing, but when you apply a bit of knowledge and logic to things, it's the fish's habitat. They are down there. And think about the continent, like sort of Cassine. You know, fish have been caught from, you know, silly depths down there, and we just need to get our heads around it because it is out of the norm for what we are used to over here.
Yeah, if you haven't fished a deep pit, like, I always remember getting messages off people who were fishing Elstow 2 for the first time. Now, that was, what, 40 foot at the deepest? The majority of the bottom was 22 to 30, would you say?
Yeah, a lot of the open water was, you know, between, I'd say between, you know, mid-30s and 40 foot when we was on there. There was the odd feature on pit 2 that came up. I think the deepest side on pit 2 was on the top of a bar in 31 foot.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of margin and snag fishing in there.
Yeah, the thing was, I used to get message off people, they're looking for spots in the open water, and there was a few bars, a couple of bars at least, weren't they, running across the lake. Now, these bars were still in 28, 30 foot of water, but they were like 35 foot around them, and people still couldn't get their head over. They're expecting a bar to be much shallower. But if you think about it, if you're finding 28 foot on the top of a bar and it's 35 around it, that's a 7 foot raise, which is a higher than me and you. It's a significant feature, and the fish still follow those features. They still use them for different reasons. They still rub on them. They still use them as guidance around a lake. And you've just got to forget that there's another 20 foot above them, because it's nothing. Like, to the fish, it's absolutely nothing. I mean, in Slovenia this year, we were fishing a deep lake. We were fishing 40 yards out, it was 12 metres, and then just behind that was 15, 16 metres. Drew had fish in 15 metres, which is like 45 foot. That's absolutely nothing. I mean, the tufties will dive in 60 foot and do on Bundy's, don't they?
Tufties. Yeah, well, I've been called a liar when I've told people that as well, and I've seen it.
Yeah, well, there was I saw a bit of a thread the other week about talking about how deep can tufties go, and then there was obviously a few people from Bundy's going, I've been picked up in 50 plus, and then the general, nobody questioned them, because if you do a bit of Googling, it does say they can dive to 50, 60 foot, so, and obviously if they have to, then obviously it becomes normal to them, if that's where the food is.
Yeah, that's one thing I'm interested in, what sort of, how much light penetrates the water down there, even when it's clear.
Yeah, I'm sure there is light. It's one thing that Gashper says to me when I was fishing abroad with him this year is they pay very little attention to rigs, because usually they're fishing 10 metres plus. Lake Bled, you can get shallower water, but all the fish get caught in the deep, in the, you know, sort of 10, 12 metres plus. So fishing 30 foot plus, there's an effect. I've heard this from divers as well, people that are trained divers. Things react differently after 10 metres, like 30 foot. The water pressure, there's a significant change in water pressure. And they don't bother with pop-ups, balance baits or anything in that sort of depth. It's really just decent sized hooks, because the power a fish has to suck food in at that depth to actually get a bait in its mouth or any food, because of the 30 foot of water pressure on it, it just negates all rigs. There's no need to fine tune anything, because they have to literally suck it in so hard that you don't have to be fancy with rigs. You know, it's literally big hook, knotless knot, and job done. Because there's no fine tuning. A fish can't be very picky at that. And I thought it was a really interesting point. So they just don't even worry about rigs in that sort of depth. But yeah, the Bundys is always the one that gets mentioned in the UK. And these two fish were 35 foot, which is not actually that deep for Bundys, is it? There's a lot. It's a lot of fish caught deeper than that.
Yeah, I've got the report in front of me. Yeah, it was Dave Padgett, and he's been fishing 35 foot and had 8 fish, including 3 30s, up to 37-12, which is cracking fishing. But it has always been like, you know, November, December into January is when Bundy's comes into its own. If you've got an understanding of thermal stratification and the thermocline and the changeover, it's just logical that they're going to be down there. But I remember when I was on there, what I'd do in... Once you got your head round, actually, you know, getting down there, I'd bounce the lead up on the bottom.
Yeah.
Because to my way of thinking, it should be, you know, soft silt, because all your rubbish, your detritus, it's going to sink down there, it's going to be soft. But if you find a hard spot down there or a firm spot, it's likely that the fish have created it.
Yep.
So that's where I'd fish. Or it's where at least I'd try and put a bait, because sinking a lead back to the exact same spot through 50 foot... is different. But the one I mentioned on that thread on the podcast, on the Carbcast fan page, it was a fish I caught. It was a January fish. It was bang on 30. One that I've since, well, after that, I found out it was called single scale. I was sat with a fella in the car park swim, and fish were showing over that sort of area. And I actually cast to a showing fish over 50 foot of water in caught. That's a bit of a mind screw.
Yeah, seeing fish stick their heads out in 50 foot and then getting a bite after it.
Off the deck. But what would you do anywhere else? If it was, you know, 10 foot, 8 foot, 15 foot, a fish shows, you're going to smash a bait to it.
Yeah, I mean, have you ever stood in like an empty swimming pool or in a lake that's empty, that's like 20 foot around you? It doesn't actually look that much, like what once you're in it. I mean, 20 foot sounds deep. But it's just getting your head around it. The fish are completely used to it. There's lots of lakes abroad around Europe that sort of depth. I remember, and I did a guest on Bundys with you one winter, didn't I? And I remember the...
Yeah, so I did.
People don't even use the marker floats on there, because when you've popped a marker float up in 50 foot, if there's any sort of undertow on the water, the actual float is nowhere near where the lead is. Like it could, because of the amount of line that you've had to let off for the float to hit the water, it could be 10 foot away.
Yeah. You know those big ESP sonar marker floats?
Yeah.
Kind of like plastic hollow.
Yeah.
I'd cast one of them down to the deep end, and from that swim, the RAF, it didn't come back up at all. I wound it in and it was cracked. The pressure had bust it.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so you don't need to worry about rigs in that deep water, which makes total sense, really. Somebody once told me about pop-ups. It makes them more buoyant at water pressure, but I don't think that's the case. I think it must just force them down. You think water's heavy, isn't it? You know, you try...
Yeah.
You know how heavy carrying a 10-litre... water bucket is. You imagine 30 40 foot plus of water on top. The weight must be incredible for those fish that are down there.
Yeah, it's, you know, pushing down on that. I can't see a pop up popping up down there at all. And like your pal Gasper says, they don't worry about it. And since you told me about it, I've been following Gasper on social media, and my god, does he catch some fish.
He does, yeah. Yeah, he really does. He's a cracking angler, and it's this time of year. He's still out, you know. He's been posting morning shots. It's getting light on bled. He's had a retainer sling with a fish in it every morning, and it's like -8s, -5s every day. I mean, last year this time of year, he was posting them up in -18 and catching. Yeah, but wow. The good thing about deep lakes is they really come into their own November, December. Something to do with the water temperature. Obviously, they hold the heat in longer, and when everywhere else has slowed up, the lakes are fishing.
Yeah, if you can imagine, if this makes sense, cold water sinks.
Yeah.
But extremely, extremely slowly. So if you imagine your shallow water that, say, I don't know, for example, Eric's Willers, it's quite shallow. That is going to be, 4 degrees, icing up temperature, top to bottom, a lot quicker than Bundy's. So the fish, they're going to go where the water is slightly warmer, but it does have a flip side. Come February, March, when there's a bit of a mild spell, Herrick's Willers, there's a good chance it's going to do a few fish because it's more sensitive and it's going to warm the fish up quicker. Bundy's ain't doing fish till April.
No, so
possibly later.
It used to be the same on Elstow, wasn't it? With average depths of 30 foot there, that they fished late into the year. There were many December, January. If you had a mild winter, even February captures, and then it'd die a death till April. It'd take much longer to heat up. But the beauty of Lake Bled and all the deep lakes over there is they don't have crappy springs like we do. They go from snow on the ground, icy, within a week to 28, 30 degrees. So it warms up really quickly, like super quick, because they'll just get 2-3 weeks of 30 plus degrees. When it was minuses the week before, there's a really quick changeover, which is why the fish grow so big over there, because they feed really late into the year. They have a couple of months shut down. And then, bang, it's hot again. They're back straight in. There's no slow wake-up period. They're straight back into it when the sun's out. Because the sun's hot, they move into the shallow waters. The rest of the lake heats up much quicker. And, it's just something.
Speaking about Bled, I've not spoke to you since I had the conversation with the missus the other evening.
Yeah.
She was, I'll show you what I put on the Facebook, but she's looking at places to go for holidays next year around the Balkans and Croatia and everything. And she's looking at places with hot tubs. That's her thing.
Yeah.
And she knows I like lakes for fishing and swimming. And she shows me this place. She says, oh, this place looks nice. Look, it's got hot tubs. There's that big lake. And it was a different angle from the shot those carp anglers are used to. But just in the background, you could see this church.
Yeah.
And I was like, that looks familiar. Let's have a look. And she says, oh, have you heard of that place? I says, just a bit. Let's go. Book it now.
Well, that campsite is really good. I've thought of you and the missus loads of times because
you've mentioned it before.
Yeah, they've got a load of wooden cabins up at the top that have got hot tubs out the front of them. They're in demand for the summer. You need to book them fairly early, those. But they're not that expensive. About 80 quid a night they are.
That's reasonable.
Obviously, I've got all the gear over there. Bring your tackle box and alarms. It's only two rods on Bled anyway. I can give you a couple of scopes or whatever. I'll come and fish with you if you do that. But it's perfect. I mean, if you're there in the summer, you can fish off the beach, which is right at the edge of the campsite, right by the restaurant. There's a bar restaurant there, pretty nice restaurant as well. The campsite's got mega facilities. You're not roughing it on that campsite. And it's, even if you're in a tent, let alone staying in one of the wooden chalets. Definitely do it. It doesn't really matter what time of year you go, I'll be able to point you in the right direction. But I've got all the gear.
It does sound ideal now. I'm just looking out the window as snowflakes are falling.
We've not had a drop of snow in Blackpool, actually.
No, we've had it very light here. There's none settled anyway. But I know there's other places of Britain that have come to a complete standstill with half an inch.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, I was supposed to be going to Clearwater today, meeting Alex, the owner, and one of my pals, Sam Holt, was going to come up there. He's on the syndicate next year, but he's not had a look yet. We do all the rain scope today, and we saw the snow warnings. We're like, oh no, that's probably written that off. And neither there, which is, Cumbria almost. It's right on the Lancashire-Cumbria border. They've not had a drop, and we've not had a drop in Blackpool. And literally 5 or 6 miles away, it's 6 inches deep. So, crazy. Yeah.
Well, I know there's just around Birmingham and Milton Keynes, I think they've got a bit, but again, not a lot. Listen, February this year, me and the wife was on holiday in Iceland. There was 2 foot of this stuff everywhere, and the roads were clear, the schools were open, and everyone just cracked on with life. What are we doing wrong?
Yeah, I look at the countries that are used to it in the winter, but they change the for snow tires or snow chains on the motors, and they're kind of geared up for it. Thing is, in England, we can't gear up for anything. Like I always say, in Blackpool, would be, you know, I go to some other towns in other hotter countries and stuff, and you know, they've got bars all down the beach and huts, and like you can't really plan if you've no idea if you're going to get a summer the following year, or you can't really plan for the cold if you've no idea if you're going to get a cold winter. I mean, we've had winters where it's averaged 10 degrees, you know, and it's fished its head off all winter, and we've got another winter we've had it, you know, like minuses for nearly 2 months. Same in the summer, we might not see a week of solid sunshine. So
that's true. I think you're wrong there. It's easy to plan for a week in Blackpool. You just take an umbrella.
Yeah, true that. Very true. Or Manchester, it's the same. It's always raining in Manchester.
Yeah, I'll tell you what you should look out for though.
Yeah,
that I've you know, certainly learnt. So I've got an app on my phone called Aurora Watch.
Oh yeah, and I've seen you share something the other day from that.
Yeah. I bet you don't have to go too far from even where you live to get away from light pollution and have an area where there's just lots of sky. Just point your camera north when there's you know, geomagnetic activity, and I bet you can photograph the northern lights from where you are. I've seen pictures from as far south as Oxford of northern lights.
Wow, do you have to pay for the app?
No, it's a freebie.
Oh, well, I'm going to get on that.
It's just Aurora Watch.
Fantastic. What else is going on this episode? So we mentioned last week that chap from the UK Otter. I better get this right now. The UK Wild Otter Trust, UK WOT, a chap called Dave Webb, I believe. It is Dave Webb. Sorry, Dave. A momentary lapse. I only spoke to you for 40 minutes the other day. But there was a piece in the Angling Times that there'd been a statement. Des Taylor originally shared it, which is what got my attention. That somebody had come out from an Otter Trust basically saying that there should have been more research, and we realise, or certainly this one trust realise, the effect that it's having on angling. And I spoke to Dave at length, thought we'd better get him on, and it was a really refreshing change to hear support from the other side, as it were. So let's play out that interview now.
The Cartcast, in association with the Northern Angling Show, the North's biggest fishing event at Event City Manchester, 24th and 25th of February. For early entry and the cheapest tickets, visit northernanglingshow.co.uk.
Hi Jamie, how are you? Alright?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
That's all right, it's important.
Well, I'm glad you think that. There doesn't seem to have been any statement from anybody outside of angling for many years.
No, that's right.
Where there is clearly a problem. And first of all, I'd like to thank you for recognising that there is a problem.
I think it's, you know, the reason I did that was because, you know, I mean, in, you know, obviously I'm reasonably well connected within the otter world, and the one thing that frustrates me is that nobody's willing to put their head above the parapet and actually acknowledge the problem initially, and that's a big step. And then if they don't acknowledge it, they're never ever going to get anglers or, you know, fishing groups on side, and it's bloody madness in my eyes.
Fantastic. So let's go back to the beginning. Tell us a little bit about you work with the Wild Otter Trust, the UK Wild Otter Trust, is that right?
Yeah, I founded it.
Okay, and just tell us exactly what that is, what that does.
It's a trust set up for initially the conservation of the Eurasian otter.
Yeah.
And we found that, you know, since starting it, that there was obviously clearly an issue with anglers and fishing. So we set about building those bridges because there was a big gap between the two. It was a very contentious issue. There was lots of conflict out there. I set about building bridges with the anglers, acknowledging the issue, and setting about seeing if we could find a solution, basically initially for still waters.
Yeah.
And seeing if we could set about trying to find a solution to try and help. And that's how this, the tracking license came about. We've got that first cracking license, as you know. So we set about getting that. We did that with support from some very high profile anglers who are still with us today and still working with us today. And we've built those bridges, started to build those bridges. There's still work to do, obviously. And the trapping license, you know, is it the be all and end all? No, it's not. There's still work to be done. And it's a small step, but it was a very important step in the right direction.
Where did you first realise there was this big divide between the anglers and with the issue of the otters? I mean, were you starting to see pictures posted on social media?
We started all, you know, probably it sort of hit, you know, we always get lots of images through and lots of people, you know, emailing us saying that we've got otters eating our fish. But it really sort of escalated probably 3-4 years ago. And it became more commonplace that we were getting lots of images sent through, and lots of people said, oh no, it's mink or foxes, and it's clearly not, you know, there's a big difference. You can tell the difference by looking at fish, whether it's been hit with an otter or not. And that's when we sort of said, look, somebody needs to step up to the mark here.
And so a lot of the contention within anglers is that otters have been re-released into the wild. They've been bred in captivity and let back out to populate the numbers. I mean, how much of that is true?
There is some truth in it in as far from the original captive breeding program that was started by a guy called Philip Ray in Norfolk. And him, along, which was the original Otter Trust, and nothing to do with us, I might add, he released, the figures we have is something, I've got them to hand here, bear with me a sec. They released about 130. And then there was another 4950 that was sent out from Vincent Wildlife Trust. And they were sent, they were put in, the first three captive bred otters were released in right about 1983 into the River Blackwater in Suffolk. And by 96 there had been captive bred releases in Suffolk, Norfolk, Northamptonshire, Hampshire, Dorset, Wiltshire, Bedfordshire and Essex, but that was a combination of all those, you know, the 130 plus the 49. And that ended once the otter population they thought was stabilised or in a better place, that captive breeding program then stopped.
And when would it have stopped?
That was shut in, it closed in 2006.
And that was the Otter Trust, so that they don't exist anymore, do they not?
They don't exist anymore. So it, the actual captive breeding programs, the last ones released was in 2006, and from then to today, there are still otters that are put back into the wild, but the importance of that is that they're not captive bred. What it is, that they're rehabs, they're orphaned, or they're injured, and if they're injured and they're obviously treated and considered fit enough to be put back into the world, they are, but it's basically rehabilitation, so it's not a captive breeding program. It's purely, to all sense and purposes, wildlife rescue, I guess.
And as far as breeding, I mean, these sort of couple of hundred otters that have gone back in over the last 15 years, what's the sort of average rate of multiplying? I mean, just those alone, forget the ones.
A female otter, they're not sexually mature until they're about 2 years old. The average lifespan is thought to be around 6 to 7 years old, and that's been established through post-mortem examinations of road kills by testing of teeth, but they usually have anything between 1 to 5 cubs. 3 is normal, so it's quite often you will see 3 cubs, and often only 2 will survive. So what I'm saying is, you know, the female with the average lifespan of 7 doesn't breed till it's 2, so it may well only have 1 or two cubs in its lifetime. So actually, the reproduction rate of them isn't as high as what some people believe.
Yeah, so maybe if they live till seven, they'll breed twice, maybe, and have two each time. So it's a sort of maximum of four and minimum of one or two, would you say?
Yeah.
Okay. So it doesn't seem like a huge amount for the... I mean, I'm fairly plugged into the fishing network via social medias and via the podcast and everything. And it's the amount of lakes that are being effective. There's obviously the rivers as well. I speak with people like Des Taylor and stuff. I don't know if I know Des Taylor shared the statement that you put out originally. I don't know if he's one of the guys you've been working with or not, but I know he's very passionate about the rivers, and the stuff I know about the rivers is secondhand from him, but certainly the lakes, it seems to be certain areas, and it seems to be every lake in that area. Is this a small amount of otters in each area that can do a hell of a lot of damage? I mean, once they find a lake with a lot of fish in it, are they just going to keep going back over the winters until they've decimated it? I mean, how does it work? I mean, how much can one otter eat? As we see, a lot of the time, the fish don't look eaten. They just look like they rip out the sort of... I'm guessing it's for the...
They take out the vital organs, which is where they leave that classic sort of V shape just behind or under the gills.
Yeah.
And they essentially need to eat 15 to 25% of the body weight every day to survive.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, 15 to 25% of something that's weighing, 7, 8 to 12 kilograms, that is unfortunately a lot of fish, because, as you say, they tend to take the vital organs because that's the easiest part of the fish for an otter to get to. It contains the most protein.
Yeah.
So what otters tend to do, the behaviour is very complex, so what they tend to do is they like to use the least amount of energy for the maximum return. And that's why they take out those fleshy parts for the with vital organs in, purely because of the protein content in that. And we tend to find that, certainly in the winter months, predation on still waters in particular will rise, purely because the rivers are in flood and they don't like exerting this energy again in fast-flowing water, so they leave. And usually predation in rivers tailors off a little bit in the winter, but you'll see it rise in still waters that certainly aren't fenced. And once that river level drops, you'll find that they usually leave the lakes again, and then, of course, the river predation starts to be noticed again.
Yeah. So, I mean, if one otter needs to kill one, maybe two carp a day to sustain itself.
Yeah.
We're looking at, some lakes might have 100 carp in. It doesn't take long, over a winter.
It doesn't, no, it doesn't. I mean, can you imagine, if you could imagine, otters staying out of rivers for a month because they're in flood in the winter, then certainly at that time, still waters do get hit really, really hard. And they tend to notice that the bigger fish go before the smaller fish, and that's simply because they become more torpid, they're easier to catch, they're slower, and it's an easy target for them.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the problems. It seems that the otters move to the still waters in the winter. In the winter, the carp, they go almost dormant, especially when it gets really cold. The bigger ones find it harder to move quickly as well.
Absolutely.
And it's a bit of a catch-22 situation. And I'm sure you're aware of the value of these carp these days, with carp fishing being so popular. I mean, some of these fish are close to priceless, because the 40 and 50 pound fish that are 30 years old, you can't buy them.
That's right. I mean, a friend of mine, Mark Walshingham, who owns Ashmead, a very, very well respected angler and very famous, stillwater carp fishery. He's fencing, and he's actually one of the guys that we've been working with. And Mark's got, fish in there, touching close to or just over 60 pounds in weight. And if he lost that fish, if an otter ever got in there, God forbid it ever happens, and I really hope it never does, his business is closed, his livelihood is gone overnight, because people pay a premium just to target that one fish.
This is the thing. It's not just the fact that the fish is priceless. Usually there's money behind the scenes as well, as in it's somebody's business. People are paying, you know, some of these syndicates are up to £2,000 a year. You know, they're like golf club memberships, and all of a sudden, you know, the equivalent for a golf club, it'd be like the MOD dropping a bomb in the middle of the course, you know, to just one day and going, it's okay, lads, you crack on, you know, because once they're gone, it can take 20 years to replace. And it's essentially livestock. These fish are a business owner, and all that's happened is the lake owner is the farmer, and the fisher is livestock. And in pretty much every other industry like this, we have a way of protecting our livestock other than just fencing. You know, the otters, they're pretty wily old creatures. I know many a lake that have fenced, and it's still not good enough. You know, they're pretty stealthy. They seem to be a very smart thing. Now, there seems to be, or certainly, I'm glad it was about three years ago you started recognising the issue, because that is when carp anglers got very vocal about it, when the river anglers started noticing the barbel vanishing. And they were getting, they seemed to be spotted a lot more, I think. You know, you saw the odd one.
I think part of the reason, I mean, obviously the anglers are the eyes for conservation, you know, and I've always maintained that. They're always out on the banks. They see far, far more than general public do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's certainly, you know, we have issues with, you know, habitat loss in particular. And that will push the otter away from a given area, and it has to go somewhere at the end of the day. And unfortunately, you know, very often they move inland into still waters, or if the, you know, habitat loss is taking place inland, then they move out towards the rivers. So, you know, unfortunately, angling is sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place, because whichever way, you know, whatever they do or whichever way they do it, you know, the otter is always going to end up somewhere on a water course, and, you know, and that causes big issues, and it does, you know, and it's something that, you know, many, many other otter groups certainly need to take on board.
What we've seen as well is that they're moving on from fish. Obviously, once they've depleted the fish stocks, you know, it then becomes fair game for other stuff. You know, I know ducks have been gone. I mean, what else will they will they eat? What else will they move on to?
I mean, they take. I mean, in terms of fish stock, certainly their favourite prey are eels. But of course, we all know that eels have declined by 90%. So you know, I think more work needs to be done on restoring eel population and habitat, but they will generally take birds. Moorhens seem to be a particular favourite, and I don't know why that is, whether they're easier to catch, but certainly moorhens, they will take ground nesting birds, they will take eggs, they will take small mammals, and they will actually eat fruit as well. So it's a massively varied prey, and they will basically, everything that an otter does is driven by food. So, you know, depending on the food source at any given place, they will adapt or move to find, you know, a suitable food supply.
I think one of the other issues has been, as far as public relations go, is the fishermen have been claiming, you know, have been complaining about them for some time, and the general public think they're quite cute. You know, they're not bad looking things. They look quite great when you see them in the zoo, or, you know, when
sure. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, pictures of otters come round, you know, and it's the same with any other animal, you know, a small fox cub, you know, small badger cub, anything like that, and the same goes with the otter. You know, people will use that to, you know, extract funds, because people tend to, you know, want to give money to, you know, cute, cuddly, furry things. But it's really, really important, and we've always tried to maintain that, you know, whilst the otter is there, you know, the general public do sometimes portray it in the wrong light, because they, you know, it's not all about being cute, cuddly, and looking really pretty.
No, they're an apex predator.
Actually, it's an apex predator, and it's an apex predator for a reason. You know, they are capable of mass destruction. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, my personal view is that if otters weren't in the rivers, or in the, you know, certainly in the rivers, you know, I think we would see bigger problems.
I mean, one of the problems is that they are native, aren't they? The Eurasian otter is native to the UK. So, I mean, they are here to stay. There's no point in the anglers. You know, anglers don't help themselves sometimes. It's been a passionate issue if you've lost a prized fish. Because sometimes these carp anglers, they'll invest 4 or 5 years trying to catch these fish, as you'll know from Ashmead, I guess.
Yeah.
They invest... emotion in it, you know, you join that ticket as well as finances. You're traveling down there week in, week out. There's a camaraderie amongst the other anglers on a lake. Is you know, you're hunting these fish to ultimately get a picture with it, you know, treat it and put it back in the water to make somebody else very happy. So that there's emotion invested as well as time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, the emotive side is, you know, what brings about some of the conflict to a point. You know, and I totally get that. And certainly in terms, you know, in terms of that, you know, a great example of that is I started speaking to a guy called Josh Faulkner, who owns a lake up in Northamptonshire.
Yeah.
And he used to be on the board of the Predation Action Group. And we, you know, our relationship really got off to a practically start, and he sort of laid down the gauntlet and said, look, come up to Northampton and come to my lake and actually see for yourself. So I went up, and we've become great friends since that. I went up to see his lake, and it was absolutely stunning. It's an old estate lake, but the day I visited, actually one of the members of his lake, which is a non-profit making water, actually one of the members there had caught the biggest fish in the lake, just over 30 pounds while I was there. And the passion, you know, and the enjoyment that was there, it was absolutely unbelievable. You had to witness it.
Yeah.
And, you know, would he have, you know, back then, would he have shot an otter? Probably would have. But by working with him and giving him the education, and education is key with otters, many, many people do not understand the complex behaviour of the otter, and we've set about, and we've worked together now, and we helped him put the fence around that lake. It's not very high, it's probably 4 foot, if that.
Yeah.
And he's not had any otter predation in there for close to 2 years. And, you know, that is a prime example of how working together, taking time to learn about the behaviour of it, engaging with otter groups, engaging with their anglers, will help.
Yeah, but, I mean, so... Let's move on to possible solutions. I know the Angling Trust have given, I think, £400,000 this year, I think, is available to help. We know, you know, anybody buying a new fishery these days would not invest money in fish. You know, there's a friend of mine just bought a fishery up at Clearwater in Carnforth in Lancashire.
I know it.
Yes, and he spent close to £200,000 on fish this year. But the first thing he did was spend £50,000 on a fence. Now, he's fortunate. Yeah. He's in a position where he can do that and has done it. And anybody buying a fishery now or investing money in fish would not do it without having a fence up first. The problem comes with you know, the hundreds of club lakes that are already in existence. Club lakes are very cheap tickets. They might be 20, 30 to £50 a year. They might have 100 members. They don't have budgets. Quite often the waters are leased. They don't own them. And then you get the leased waters are on other people's property where they can't fence, and then obviously you've got everything else, the rivers and stuff that's just impractical. So I know you can get a license now to trap. If you have a fenced property, you can trap within your fence for any otters that are on the inside of the fence. They're not the issue. Anybody that's already fenced a lake is not the issue. It's the people that either can't afford to do it or can't physically do it. Now, what most owners or people that own the syndicates around the fish would like to do is to protect their fish from the otter.
Yeah.
What sort of things are you working on at the minute with people? Where do you think we can do something about this?
It's a very difficult one. Rivers always have been and always will be an awkward one. I think with rivers, you know, we have to bear in mind, people seem to forget that, you know, the Angling Trust published, you know, figures or data saying that 74%, I think it was, of our rivers in the UK are sustainably you know, they're unsustainable for fish stocks and other wildlife, and that's a big problem, certainly for fish stocks. And we have to, you know, look at habitat destruction around the rivers. We have to look at gravel abstraction. We have to look at dredging. We have to look at the EA, you know, chucking in, you know, hundreds of thousands of fish into the rivers where they, you know, where they've been hit hard with, you know, a very, you know, varied predator, I might add, not just the otter, but, you know, cormorants, crayfish, and that sort of thing. And we have to go back to basics. We have to look at rivers. We have to get those environmentally, ecologically sustainable for fish stocks. And once that's done, you will find that natural balance. That natural balance will naturally occur. The problem with that is that it's a very, very long-term solution. It's not going to be a quick fix. And that is the only way. I mean, people are, you know, I've had conversations with people about, you know, farmers' rights, for example, with otters. And comments have been made, you know, otters shouldn't be in this stretch of river. They need to be taken out from, you know that particular area. It won't work. Because of the complex behaviour of the otter, any voids created will be filled reasonably quickly. And the only way to make anything like that work would be a complete eradication of a native protected species. And it will never, ever happen.
Mm.
You know, it really is, putting it blunt, they're chasing a pipe dream.
Yeah.
It just won't happen. And it would never be effective. You know, if I thought for 1 minute that it would work and it would be effective, you know, we would probably support it. But it won't. It wouldn't benefit the fish stocks. It wouldn't benefit the angling. It wouldn't benefit any predators. So what is the point? There's no point doing something. It's not going to be of any, you know, benefit to anything else surrounding it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds to me, I mean, the rivers have been an issue nationally for the government for a long time. I mean, you know, rivers are an important network in the UK, and, you know, we have floods in certain, you know, extreme weather conditions. We know that the water can't move down fast enough. You know, there seems to be an ongoing issue with the rivers needing dredging, cleared through. You know, the pollution issues, so that the fish stocks are great. I mean, it sounds to me like an eel stocking program, you know, a heavy one, may well help.
That's what's needed. I mean, I met with Sean Nurse from the Barber Society last weekend, and we had a long conversation about this. And, you know, eels are key to it. I'm based down in North Devon, and we monitor the rivers down here, and luckily, you know, all the rivers, you know, they're primarily trout and salmon and grayling.
Yep.
But there are coarse fish there as well, and catches go up year on year. Predation is hardly ever seen, but the rivers are full of eels. So we're in a lucky position down here that, you know, there's lots and lots of eels. And if you could put, you know, a river full of barbel, you know, a lake full of carp, or a bucket full of eels, and the otter will always go to those eels. And it's as simple as that. And one of the problems that we see with the EA chucking in, you know, lots and lots of fish, it's not really a solution, because all they're doing is topping up the food source. So the graph, if you look at a level line, it suddenly blips to a top, to a peak. You know, all the time they're filling in fish, it stays at that peak. It will never drop again. It will never find that balance. So they're, to all intents and purposes, by doing that, albeit, you know, people might think it's helpful and useful, actually it's having the reverse effect, because it's keeping predation at a high.
It's just throwing them more food. Yeah, so I mean, this is something we can look at with the eels. I mean, are we ever going, you're saying that, I want to ask you more about this complex behaviour of the otters. You're saying that just purely hunting them, you know, if we're seeing them on a stretch of river, hunting the otters is not going to help. Enlighten me a little bit more as to why.
The one question that I'm asked many, many times, you know, is how many otters are there? What's the population?
Yeah.
We do not know. It's very unlikely now that we will ever know. I wouldn't even guess how many we've got. But what we do know is that through sprint counting, we do know that otters are thought to be in every county of the UK.
Hmm.
Now, we also collate records of sightings of both live and dead. Yesterday, as an example, we had 8 reported to us being killed on roads, and that's only us getting the reports. I'm sure you could probably double that.
Yeah.
And people say, actually, you know, isn't that really sad? Well, yeah, it is, but, you know, actually, if you think about it, does that indicate a healthy population whereby we can afford to lose those? Or are we really losing, you know, an important number of what is already a fragile population? Personally, I don't believe the otter population in the UK is fragile.
No.
And, you know, geographically, in other parts of, you know, Europe, because they have a massive geographical range, the Eurasian otter, far down to Asia, you know, they think through various testing and monitoring that those numbers are considerably lower than they are in the UK. And if that's the case, the otter in the UK will never ever be taken off the protected list in case a stop is needed. Yeah. Or if to all intents and purposes, another captive breeding program. You know, personally, I wouldn't like to see that, because I think the other countries would end up having the same issue as what the UK is having now. But, you know, that's the reasoning behind it, and that's why they'll never be taken off that protected list.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd never seen an otter on the road.
No.
You know, in 30 years of driving, I've never seen one killed. You know, I've only seen it. 2 badgers, I think, in my lifetime, sort of dead on the road. So the fact that there has been a number, you know, well, in the last day, you've seen that many. That says to me there's a healthy population of otters out
there.
Yeah,
right. You know, I tend to agree with that. You know, because what we're getting, you know, we're getting more and more sightings, you know, week on week. And if the population was taking a, you know, a heavy battering, then obviously that would drop, and people would stop reporting. Anglers would stop reporting seeing them. Anglers would stop reporting, you know, predation being a real pain. But, you know, it's not. It's still going up. So, yeah, you know, it tells me that the population of otters in the UK is healthy.
So,
but, you know, we need to go back to basics in order to address that and to try and get that balance out, because the natural balance with otters will occur, but we have to concentrate on the bottom of the river before we start concentrating at the top.
Yeah, I agree. So I think everybody would support sorting the rivers out for a multitude of reasons other than just the food sources. I mean, obviously, you know, it helps with floodings. There's many lakes affected by flooding when we get heavy rain, as well as roads and stuff. The fish stocks have been an issue in rivers for many years, pollution, farmers. So, it looks like that. I mean, do you speak regularly with the EA?
We have contacts within the EA, we do, yes. Not so much on the river thing. It's something that we're just sort of getting to grips with now, and really that's a little bit late, I feel, but it's something that, you know, previously we've not prioritised, and I think now we need to start sort of pushing that and, you know, working together. And it's important that, you know, anglers and fishery owners realise that actually, you know, there is an otter group out there that does want to genuinely help. But we can't do it alone. You know, we need support from anglers and fishing. Likewise, anglers and fishery owners can't do it without the support of the otter groups, and that's why it's so important for everybody to work together, because if we don't, we're never going to get a solution. We're never going to find that balance. You know, it just won't be, it won't be possible.
I'm really pleased that you're doing this, and you seem like, you know, you're very objective to otters and to fish. You know, a practical solution is fantastic to hear from somebody on the otter side of the fence. Tell me about the other otter groups. Are there a number of them? Have you released this statement to them? And what's their opinion on your view?
I don't know if everybody's seen it, but certainly some otter groups have seen it, they've read it, and they, you know, yes, they are supportive of it. So they're coming round, you know, and we have the same issue within the otter world as the anglers have. You know, you're always going to get the minority, the small minority that just won't have it and just won't agree, won't acknowledge anything. Like, you know, as I say, like you do in the angling world, that... No matter what you tell them, give it to them on a golden plate, nobody, you know, they just won't accept it. But generally, they are coming round. You know, we're looking at, or at the moment, a
another conference has been organised for probably June of next year, where all this is going to be discussed. You know, we're going to have some high profile people there. They're going to be coming from all over the world to it.
Yeah.
Probably going to be held up north somewhere, Keele University, I think. And that's going to be the ideal time there to get everybody on board and actually get this message across.
Fantastic. Well, I'd like to thank you for having an open mind and for already working with some anglers. I'd like you to keep in touch if we can. I'll pop you an email if you can send me any future press releases or any info.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Any info that comes that way, and I'll make sure I can get it out here. The attitude of some anglers does annoy me. I mean, anglers have been pretty angry for a few years because they felt they were being ignored or the problem was being ignored. So
yeah.
Under any EA post, you know, that had a picture of an otter or anything, or, you know, look at us, we're doing a great job in the rivers, you will see a barrage of replies underneath saying otters, kill them, shoot them, you know. And it's, I think a lot of that has just been an angry reaction. I think now we know that our voice is being heard, you might see a more diplomatic response from anglers, and I want to help with that. It annoys me seeing a lot of these, oh, just cull them, just kill them, because that isn't the solution. Everybody knows that, you know.
It's frustration, unfortunately, you know, and I get it totally, you know. It's frustration, you know, it's not the angler's fault, it's not the otter's fault, you know, it's man's intervention that's caused this problem, it's man's intervention, it's man's, you know, doing with habitat, you know, destruction, and until we get that sorted out, you know, there's always going to be an issue. But, you know, if we're going to sort it out, let's sort it out. Let's get everybody working together, you know, angling groups, EA, angling trust, otter groups, pull together, and hopefully, you know, we could see a change, you know, and we could see a change reasonably quickly as well if we all work together to, you know, for the same objective.
Yeah. Yeah, it's well, thank you for talking to us, Dave. Dave Webb from the UK Wild Otter Trust. And hopefully we'll be speaking again soon.
Yeah, my pleasure, Jamie. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dave.
The Carpcast is sponsored by Clearwater Fisheries, the North Premier Fishery Complex. For more details, visit clearwaterfisheries.co.uk.
So, what a refreshing change, Mark. Somebody who understands anglers, been meeting with anglers. It seems a bit weird that the trust that released the otters decided they'd done their job and just shut that trust down. I didn't ask Dave how many otter trusts there are around, but he's certainly making inroads to them. They have general meetings, as he said. They've got one coming up, and they're certainly going to bring up this issue of fishing. And it's great, you know, all these pictures that have been being shared, you know, because they look quite horrific, don't they? The carp with the, you know, with all the sort of innards ripped out and like the familiar V shape under their vital organs. I mean, they are quite graphic, these pictures, but they've had a positive effect. These pictures have been seen by, you know, people like Dave who have acted on it. You know, he's come out, they've done a bit more research, he's befriended some anglers, some lake owners, seen carp on the bank, you know, seen the love that we give them, the you know, the way we handle them, the way we treat them, the way we put them back. He's now friends with fishery owners that have told him how much these fish are worth, you know, 30, 40-year-old carp, virtually priceless. You know, you can't just go and buy a 50-pound carp. But if you were to put a price, you know, it's 20, 30, 40,000 pound per fish, and whole lakes are being decimated by, you know, these apparently cute looking things. And just the fact that it wasn't even acknowledged by anybody other than the anglers. What a massive victory. And the fact that somebody like that is now championing the course within the other otter groups for not just carp anglers, for all anglers. And it seems to be that all we've got to do is get an eel stocking program in all the rivers. And if you've got a lake that you cannot fence because, maybe it's not your land to fence, or maybe it's impractical or going to be too expensive, surely it's cheaper to stock eels. That's certainly going to have a positive effect on, on them not on the otters not eating your carp. If you give them a choice of carp and eels, they're going to eat the eels. So surely you should have a yearly stocking program of eels into the lakes.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and it's an interesting solution. Although, have you ever heard of anyone actually breeding eels? Because they do the spawning way out in the Sargasso Sea and then migrate back to our rivers. So I'm not going to claim to be an expert on eel breeding, but
have you ever seen the
eels?
Have you ever seen the eels migrating off a lake or a river?
It was on the net. It must be true.
Yeah,
but no, that's a bit long been the thing.
Now it's
bouncing and coming. Are we wrong?
I remember Roger telling me the story of it. He's seen it once. I'll remind him actually next time I speak to him. He'll hear this and let me know. But yeah, I'm sure he told me the story one time of seeing them, because there's literally packs of them.
Yeah,
I've seen the rats do it. You know, when the rats migrate in like massive groups.
Yeah,
and I've seen them do it when I was young on a lake.
I'll tell you a lie, I have actually seen it. Mm. Yeah, we're going. I should remember this. It was on Thorpe Marsh Power Station pond that I've already mentioned.
Yeah,
this is it's going back a long, long time. It's when there was. Was it 98, 99, where there was some real bad floods?
Mm.
You know, the River Don, you know, about a mile upstream of where it goes past Thorpe Marsh Power Station, there's like some massive floodgates, gates in the flood bank, and it just opens and releases the river and floods several hundred acres of just, you know, nothing land, you know, in a few fields. And when it gets really bad, it goes over, it closes one road, and that's it. But this year it even reached over to the golf course and the fishing pond, and I remember I was down there just watching it flow in, and I was there with my wife, and she said, "What the hell's that?" And several eels were swimming up it. It was, I'd never even seen an eel in the lake, and there was quite a few. It was like, where the hell did they come from? But yeah, it was quite exciting to see in a long time back as well.
I spoke to Kevin Nash earlier. We're going to play his interview out in a minute. Kevin drained the Copse Lake down very recently and found eels in the bottom of there, which were never in there. He dug that lake from scratch, dug it themselves, stocked it with carp. They put a few jackpike in to keep the fry down, and that was it. And had eels, a few eels in the bottom.
There's no streams in or out of the Copse, is there? Or church?
No, there is. I think there is some sort of ditch, irrigation ditch, running somewhere nearby, which they must have come up there. I don't know, but I think they can go across land for quite a way. I'm sure they can.
Yeah, I think as long as it's wet and, you know, doing through like damp grass or something, they can.
Well, apparently, according to this statement that Dave's released as part of the UKWOT, as you heard, he gave us a lot of facts about the actual numbers. We think that the otters are fairly in every county. So, you know, and this is a guy from the Otter Trust saying this, so you cannot ignore the problem. The eel population is thought to have diminished by 90%, which is a lot, which is one of the things. We talk about what we can do with rivers. I mean, the river system needs sorting out anyway, as we know. And there are obviously other uncontrolled invasive species, mink and signal crayfish, which are not really meant to be here. But yeah, it was very interesting. I'm glad we've got somebody from the other side of the coin seeing the angler's point of view and wanting to work together. Sounds like Dave's fairly influential in that scene. I know he's had a voice in Parliament in the past, so it's only positive. And whenever there is otter talk, we can get Dave on and get the actual truth from their side of it. But I'm glad to see that all finally, you know, all these images being posted have had an effect, and it stirred Dave to wanting to talk to anglers or you know, lake owners and stuff, and see our side of it, and completely agrees we have to work together. And he understands what an otter is. As he said, we can't just cull them or kill them. It's never going to happen. They're protected species all across Europe, and even though they're quite healthy in the UK, they're not in some other countries, and they are a native species. So, you know, we're never going to cull them and kill them, but there are things we can do if we work together. So I'm pretty safe to say they're not going to be releasing any more. But yeah, it's I think some work with the EA is in order. We we've rambled on quite a lot. It's been full story time, this particular one, hasn't it, Mark? We've nearly done our sort of hour that we normally do, and we've hardly done any news or anything, but I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, it has been... I do like these story ones, but I think one last thing I've got to add on the eel thing. Yeah. If all our Cockney friends stop eating jellied eels, they'll stop being farmed, and the rivers will be restocked naturally.
I think. Are they the...
I'll get my coat.
Okay, Kevin Nash has a new book coming out. In fact, I have it right in front of me because I read it. It was that good. I read it in a night. It's called Memoirs of a Carp Fisher. It's certainly worth a look. Herman's Hole, which is a reference to Warmwell, where he fished. Half the book is stories, finishing on from his last one, which you said you couldn't get enough of, Mark.
Yeah, I read his first one, The Demon, I believe it was called, and it's one of those books where I was well into it, which is good for me. I don't generally read books. And when I got to the end, I want more. You know, the story wasn't finished. So I'm glad he's done another one, and I shall certainly be diving in.
Well, the first half of this does do exactly that. Yes, he says in the foreword that there were stories that there wasn't enough room for in the first one, and that's what he's done here. In fact, he talks about, it's quite interesting actually, talking about going over to Lake Shearer, which is where he first got the idea for the Titan from, watching the trees in horrendous winds over there. So, I mean, I won't spoil the book. We talk about it quite a bit in the interview. Quite enjoyed chatting with Kev about it. I'll tell you one of the interesting things we spoke about after the interview, but it is in the book. The Chod rig. Have you ever urban ditched me what Chod is?
I'm not sure I want to.
It's, I forget which country now, but it's basically, in some countries it's referred, you know, like we say fuck for shag or sex. Yeah. It's a sex term. Well, Chod is a sex term in certain countries. The fuck it rig. Yeah. I just thought it was quite funny. It's in the book.
It's quite apt as well, to be honest.
Nod to don't Chod. That's us.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got that right about my missus anyhow. Married life. So, I'll get my coat too.
Yeah.
I can give this book away now. I've read it. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Should we come up with a way of giving it to one of our listeners?
Yeah. I'll tell you what. We'll have a little discussion after this. We'll come up with a good one. Should we just do... I always find caption competitions on pictures quite amusing. If you've got a good suitable picture that people can be funny with.
Okay, tell you what we'll do. Check out our Carpcast page. We will find a picture that's got some relevance to either the book or Kevin or the Carpcast or whatever. We'll find a suitable picture and get you to caption it. And the best one can have this copy of Kevin's book. In the meantime, let's get Kevin on and let's have a chat about it. So I'd like to welcome, back from his travels, been all over the world again, Carpcast favourite and regular, Mr. Kevin Nash. How are we doing, Kev?
I'm doing well, Jamie. Good to hear you, fella. Come back to the cold, as you say. Yeah.
Yeah.
This winter, I guess.
Definitely. It has been cold this last week or two. I'm sure you've had it down south as well. You kind of escaped it being 250 miles south, but yeah, we've had zeros, minuses.
Last winter we had only 7 frosts. I think we've had about, there's a couple on our way at least. We've had at least 7 or 8. Interesting enough, Adam went fishing yesterday to a local club lake that me and him always rely on. It's the best winter water I know. And he blanked. He said he never saw a fish. He said it was absolutely dead. So I do wonder if they've gone into their little winter sleep. I've got this thing there, the 6-week hibernation as soon as the cold hits. If that's the case, then they're going to wake up and be catchable by the end of January, whatever the weather, snow or whatever.
I remember you saying this last year. I remember you saying there was a, once they do shut off, it's 6 weeks, and then they wake up regardless of conditions, which is interesting. I do think that first week we had a prolonged cold spell, minuses for multiple nights in a row. And as you know, Roger was down at your place fishing Church, and he had a number of fish equivalent with the summer session, to be honest, with the spring session. He finished up with like 11 or 12 fish, which is crazy because I think he'd had like 6 or 7 in the first 2 days.
Interesting about that is they often have a big feed up just before they go into hibernation. So, as I said, I wouldn't have thought the weather's been prolonged or cold enough, but it is strange how that water that's so productive is completely shut down. But we'll see the next few weeks if they illustrate it.
Yeah, very much so. And you drained the cups down as well. I remember Roger was saying there was a couple of little pools in there, and there was a couple of the lads, Ollie Davison, saying that's it, there's no fish left in there, 100%, there's nothing, it's dead. And then I think they found 8 out in that little pool.
Yeah.
8 commons, but no big ones turned up.
Alan, when he was wading through the silkweed, he bumped into clearly a big fish that was decomposed. I do wonder, as we dropped the level, it trapped him in the siltweed and killed off. There's two fish I couldn't account for. Scarlet was over 50 and T-shirt, which is normally about 48, 49. It's one of them, isn't it? I don't know. I don't know what's happened to. Certainly there's one big fish Alan found dead in there, so that's one of them.
Yeah, there was definitely a 41 pounder that went back in. I saw pictures of it caught by one of the guys on one of your trips on there last year, and it went back in the lake. I got sent a picture of it, and I saw a wide fish. I've seen it twice this year. I saw a wide fish in September when I was pushing the barrow back from one of the Church Lake trips. It was sat under the scumweed on that new little bay bank that you dug near the path, and I watched it swim out, and it definitely wasn't one of the 20s. It was a 40 pound fish. So is all the water completely gone? No,
you can never get all the water out. You get all this silt in the bottom, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's a couple in the silt. I remember when I drained down the garden lake where I was holding the stock to take down to the cups. It was completely empty, and being a relatively new lake, it was quite a firm bottom. And I'm sitting on the bank, really upset, because my big common, i.e. Emperor, that was around 30 then, re-netted it, the lake was empty. I was absolutely gutted, trying to think what the hell happened to that. And a mate of mine walked across the bottom and suddenly let out a shout, dived into the silt and come out with the common. It had clay going from its head at least 15, 18 inches up its body. It literally drilled itself into the bottom.
Wow.
I remember when they drained and netted Longfield, filled it up again, and if I recall, there's like 10 fish, 10 of the original still in there. So, they will drill themselves in the bottom.
It's very interesting, I think, having a look at lakes when they're empty, especially if you've cast leads around in them and just seeing what's there that you didn't know, what you did know. And Roger said the main thing that he noticed on the cop, so we knew all the spots. There was no spots or areas that we weren't very aware of. But what he said is everything you thought was a small spot was way bigger than what you ever imagined. Like all these ones that you thought were sort of dustbin lid sizes were generally bivvy sized. it's weird, isn't it, when you feel with the lead. And I've always said that stuff is much bigger than you think it is.
I've had a walk in it. It's actually filled up quite quick. Get the pumps back in after winter and drain it right down and then try and dry it out. Then we put a rotavator through it and lime it and all that. But what was very apparent to me is, they are like mini bulldozers. The way they've dug out the bottom, slopy areas I had in the bottom, some of them are sheer cliffs. Interesting enough as well, they dug out big holes around every lily bed in there.
Really?
I remember I'm a firm believer the best way to find out what the bottom's like is to walk a lake. Of course, obviously you can't walk across a lake unless it's shallow, but one year I walked all around the margin. I found five rock-solid places where, you know, where they obviously were feeding on them regularly and recently. Three of them were in front of flag irises.
I only had three beds of flag irises, that's the yellow ones, in the lake.
Yeah.
And in every instance, the bottom was rock hard around them.
Wow. Mm. Yeah, so lily pads, flag irises. Have you learned anything for when you redo it?
Sorry?
Have you learned anything from where you sort of prepare the lake to start again?
Not really, I don't think.
No, it's going to be an interesting project, though. I've never restored a lake before. They say the first 15 years are the most richness, and you know, you can see the way the silt's built up in there, how it's, you know, going backwards, as it were, and say a lot that's down to the carp, you know, the way they just, you know, dig up all the bottom. You know, what was interesting, there's a load of eels in there.
Really?
I was quite gobsmacked. What we've got, as you know, Joan, is that ditch that's winter feed that eventually ends up in the River Crouch. I don't know how long, how far it goes around to get it, but it's got to be at least a mile, maybe 2 miles. And so the eels must have come up with the winter water and
smelt and found the cops and got in it.
Wow. Have otters ever been a concern around there?
No, but, you know, I don't live in a comfy place that I never have.
You know, miles away from any river, freshwater river or whatever. And I only hope, because the crouch is salt water, and otters don't like salt water, unless, of course, you're a sea otter, that I'll get away with it. But as I say, I'm never going to be complacent. The damn things are getting everywhere, you know.
Yeah. Did you see last week the statement from a guy called Dave Webb, who is part of, I think it's the Wild Otter Trust, WOT or something, and he's actually come out and made a statement, well, it was reported wrongly in Angling Times. I think he was misquoted quite a bit. He has agreed to come on the show, so I should be speaking to him later, but just wanted your opinion. It's the first person that's ever connected with otters that actually seems to understand angling, waterways, rivers, and has said, we've made a mistake. We should have had this information. We should have known more about what we were doing before we did it. Now, he wasn't involved in that release in the 60s and 70s, but he's very active now. He's got a voice in government, and he sounds like he's a very good person to get on side with the anglers. So he was a bit annoyed about being misquoted in Angling Times on a few things, but it seems like a huge step in the right direction for anglers.
Oh, doesn't it? Yeah, you need to get him on the show. Yeah, you know, the fact is, as anglers, we're at the sharp end, and you know, we're the eyes, and you know, what I can't understand is the attitude of the RSPB, because otters are killing loads of birds, full stop.
Yeah.
Full stop, you know. I think I've said before, why don't we chuck lions into London, or, you know, brown bears into Birmingham? The fact is, their natural food sources, crays and eels, are depleted, you know. So stuff they would have eaten isn't available now. And I do hear a lot of evidence that these ones they've introduced are far more communal. You know, they don't fight and, you know, try and protect the territory. You know, so they will overstock, for want of a better word, you know, an area, river, or whatever. You know, so it
was a misplaced decision. And let's hope that this guy, his voice, will get people thinking and listening more.
Certainly. Certainly. I had the pleasure of receiving a copy of your book very recently. Your new
one. Have you gone in the bin yet?
Not at all. No, it's a very nice book, actually. Very collectible, I would say. The photography in it is fantastic. The quality of the pages are fantastic. I love the little illustrations. Who have you got to do those?
Oh, what's his name? God, I can't think. Carl, someone is.
He's done a really.
I can't remember his name, but all I do know is he's famous as the best illustrator of fishing books. I was really lucky that he agreed to do mine, because he's got like a 2-year waiting list to work.
Alan, I don't know the lad. Alan knows him well, and Alan managed to bend his arm. And yes, big up to him. Also, I'm embarrassed, I can't remember his name.
Carl Stannard, I've just had a look in the front of the book to find out, because he deserves a mention.
Embarrassing further, we didn't even get his name right. I think it's Craig Stannard.
Oh, you're joking.
One typo that's been identified in the book.
sorry, Craig.
He was all right about that, but no, some of those illustrations are amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, he has signed them all, so I'm guessing people may recognise his signature. Yeah, one made me chuckle in there. I think it was in the Warmwell bit. Obviously, he spent a bit of time in the bar there, and he'd on the pump that's in the background, you know, the beer pump behind you in the background. Yeah, yeah. He'd written, I forget what it was now, he'd written something on the pump. His attention to detail. Just see if I can find that picture now. It was pretty funny. It did make me chuckle, because I know you like a drink, and I can imagine fishing somewhere like that with on a holiday camp with a bar and restaurant on site. I can imagine.
Yeah, it did get a bit messy in there some nights, as I say, that chapter, the hunt for birth. I love
the picture of the pond in the bar, West Bay or whatever it was, with the flower pot and the leaves.
it was really good. So if we go back to the start of the book, book, I like how you've done it in two halves, the way you finish off with the Warmwell section at the end of it, and then saying, you know, realising that you enjoyed teaching the kids, and you know, showing other people, and other people catching, you know, big and on your rods, and led very nicely into the instructional section. Now I've had technical chats with you a lot about fishing, but I've got to say, I wanted more stories. The stories were so well written, I thought, considering I've heard a lot of them before. I couldn't put it down. I read the book in one night, in one sitting. I read it till I finished. So the book starts off with Warmwell.
The Angry Warmwell, that's the last of
Four Lakes that I talk about, isn't it?
Sorry, yeah, the bit in the Canaries, I want to go there, because I know that lake, I've fished it myself. I didn't realise you fished it that early, and something else that I didn't know that you hadn't told me was that you came up with the idea for the Titan on there because of those big winds that trashed, you gave your brolly away, didn't you?
That's right. Well, yeah, that's exactly what happened. You know, a hurricane coming. It wasn't that night, but another strong wind one day. I was opposite this really high cliff with sparse pine trees on top, and there was one zinnia deciduous tree
swaying more and more in the wind, and I was watching them, and then it just, you know, massive sway to side, and the main bough just cracked in half. You know, I thought, wow, yeah,
but the pines, even, you know, they're on top of that rocky crag, you know, so they just weren't moving, you know, so, you know, kind of thought, well, the wind's just going through them, and they are a stable, you know, non-flexible structure, whereas if a flexible structure, you know, gets flexed beyond its limit, it will break, you know. Then, you know,
it's all flexible bodies and hutchy dome tents with flexible ribs, so where the Titan was the first, not only in its, you know, unique mechanism, but it was the first shelter that had a rigid frame.
Yeah, because there was always some give. I think if you went too far the other way, one of the bivvies, I forget what it was called, was it like an evolution or something? It was super floppy. I always remember describing it like a blade of grass. Blades of grass don't break either. They just flex all the way over in a wind. But then obviously, if you're in it, you don't want it touching your nose while you're sleeping, do you?
Yeah, that's right. They used to be like sitting in a jelly, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's that period in beneath, which, like you say, the branches snap off trees in high winds, or, you know, certain types of trees will just snap.
Yeah, when you look at nature now, you know, all those trees that flex, you know, they're all deciduous. You know, and that's why if you get a summer storm or a hurricane, it can do so much damage. In fact, it often will. Like what happened in those September gowns in the 80s, it uprooted whole oak trees, you know, because there's such a force there, you know, to wind resistance, you know, and I guess that's why
nature designed them for the leaves to fall off in winter, so the wind could flow through.
Yeah, I can imagine discovering Shearer in the, was it the 80s you first went there?
Yeah, 88.
Discovering a place like that up the mountains, I mean, I've been a few times over the last sort of 15 years, more recently 4 or 5 years ago, so I know the lake reasonably well. I mean, discovering that in an age where tackle wasn't as good, it's quite extreme up there, isn't it? I mean, even when it's hot, it's cold at nights because it's so high up and there's no light pollution. Even now, there's not really any bars or restaurants up there. I did laugh with that. You were talking about the long sort of thin bar where you watched the football one night, was it? And you were cooking the omelettes, the funny green yeah. omelettes. I'm sure that's the place that was famous for its eggs. It had some big hens or something out the back, and I'm sure I had egg and chips in there 2 or 3 days in a row.
Really? Well, I wasn't aware of that, and so I certainly never saw any chips. I've always had some. You know, as you know, I lived for 2 weeks on bread, cheese, and honey. You know, it was
tackle-wise, yes. Tackle wasn't the standard it is now, but you know, the other problem, of course,
you know, as I described quite vividly in the book, was getting the tackle over there. I literally just had an oval brolly, a bed chair, an army sleeping bag, one change of clothing. You know, that's all the weight allowance I had, you know, and bank sticks and that, you know.
It's crazy that you...
Force 10 saved the day, you know, that Force 10 undersuit, which I still use to this day. Yeah. All going. Yeah. That is a piece of clothing that, you know, will never come out of my rucksack. You know, a number of times that saved me, and it saved me on that trip.
Yeah, very similar to the new scope suit that you've kind of brought back. So for those people that can't picture it, it's like a big all-in-one, isn't it? And we had a lot of those in the 80s. I had a blue Sundridge one, I think it was, and then later on the green Nash one.
Yeah, the blue Sundridge one, that was a big fleecy thing, you know, that was more just for winter. But, you know, the Force 10 undersuit, as I used to call it, as you say, we got it in the scope range. It's just a light quilted suit, you know, it's so flexible, even on a winter's evening and get chilly, you know, you'd be there in shorts and a t-shirt and it's feel chilly, so, you know, just bang that on and so you sleep in it like pyjamas.
So when you get out at night, you know, when it's really cold, you're not freezing while you're playing the carp, you know, so, and it just helps you with that extra layer, you know, when you need it.
It saved me on Lake Bled this year. It was supposed to be quite warm when I went back in September. I envisaged it being warm, and I threw in a couple of sets of waterproofs and I threw in that suit just in case. I knew Lake Bled being days only, and you're not allowed much kit on there. And oh my goodness, it didn't stop raining for 2 weeks solid, and that suit just saved me. Because obviously you sat out there till 11 o'clock at night, you're back out again at 3 o'clock in the morning, you've been damp from the night before. And I was so glad I bought it. I don't think I could have survived without it if I hadn't have taken that with me. And I will never be without that in my van, car, rucksack, whatever.
I pushed to get a version put in the scope range, but I'm still using the originals. You know, when I can't remember what. Oh, I know why. The company who made that quilting went out of business. The original quilting, which was welded. So I grabbed three, and I'm still using the original ones from the early 90s.
Well, Roger posted an old school picture of Darrenth in the 90s, early 90s, a couple of fish the other day. They got quite a bit of interaction, and he had that very same suit on. There's a few people commenting on it on the picture. Yeah, it's funny how some things change. That blue Sundridge suit that I had, I remember that was terrible in wind. It just used to let the wind right through it. I mean, it was very warm and fleecy. If you had a cold night, if you had a cold night with no wind, it was great, but you had to wear sort of clothes over it, but it was quite bulky. So yeah, I'm very glad of my scope suit now. There's a picture of a bottle of tequila in the in the shearer section of the book. I get the impression that having a few drinks was quite a running theme through some of them 90s sessions. It looks like a lot of fun was had.
Well, in the case of the cheerer, you know, so I used to pull off the lake in the evening to get some substance. And, you know, why wouldn't you have a drink or two at the same time? It wasn't worth fishing it at night. You know, I think the biggest fish I ever caught was an 18-pounder. But throughout my carp fishing career, it's been a pub near a lake. I've generally used that pub. I've never been a great cooker on the bank, which is ironic because, as you know, I love cooking, but some reason I hate cooking on the bank. I'm really lazy. So if I can find a pub, you know, pull off at lunchtime or whatever, you know, have a break from the lake, have a drink, something to eat, you know, a decent meal, and then off you go. And, you know, the other thing that pulling off the lake can do, you know, and get your head straight again, you know, so I think I talk about it at Walmart at times, is hitting our head against a brick wall on one particular session. Every lunchtime we pull off, we walk in the bar, all absolutely dejected, blah, blah, and then over a couple of pints and a meal, we come up with a new plan and go back to the lake fired up again, you know, until that one didn't work. But, you know, it can often be a real confidence booster. You know, don't get me wrong, you know, I do like a drink, but I've never been drunk on a lake in my life, and you know, I wouldn't, because then possibly you could jeopardise the safety of a carp, not to mention piss other people off.
Yeah, pubs have always been part of British culture, probably much less these days. Everything's owned with chains and the smaller independent ones have shut down and stuff, but you've just reminded me, it was a bit of the magic of me reading the early Hutchie books and stuff, and, you know, you had the Horse and Barge that was a well-known angler's pub that serviced a number of lakes around Harefield, Savay, that sort of area. I mean, it used to have a disco on the Friday night, didn't it, where people from all over came. And then there was a boozer near Raysbury, I forget what that one was called, that was quite famous, that everybody used to...
Yeah, what was that called? I can't think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Horse and Barge was incredible. You know, it used to attract hundreds and hundreds of carp anglers. You know, hundreds, you know, it was a great atmosphere in the summer's night, you know.
Yeah.
Hundreds of carp anglers and faces all standing outside drinking, you know. It was a very unique time in carp fishing history, and indeed pubs, you know. Holes and Barge, I'm not even sure where it's open now. Last I heard it closed, you know, there's a shadow of what it used to be. You know, and even my local, the Anchor, Jamie, which you've been to, which, as you know, is a really smart gourmet pub. Well, one Christmas I had a Christmas party down there. Must be 150, 200 friends, carp anglers, and that turned up. Roger Smith, Kerry. In actual fact, they bivvied up in the back garden, and the landlady, which at the time is, you know, is now Dixie, she went out and made them bacon sarnies in the morning. Now, where would that ever happen? Yeah, where would that ever happen in a pub nowadays? Yeah, whole new era.
It is, yeah. And I mean, it was part of the magic of me reading those books. You know, when I first, I was born down south. When I moved back down in my late teens, early 20s, I ended up living near Watford. Well, in Watford, actually, which is, as you know, on the edge of the Colne Valley. And, you know, one of the first things I did was drove down that road, had a look at Harefield, the lakes down there, and went to find that pub because it was synonymous. I mean, that's part. I think we've missed a bit of that magic.
It was a Horse and Barge where Martin Locke was nearly killed.
Really? I don't know that story.
A car full of lads come, there's like kind of humpback bridge hill there. Mm. They come flying over the hill, lost control, and ploughed into Martin. Right outside the pub, and I think he was catapulted like 50 yards through the air.
No way.
That's why they always talk about him locking in stainless steel. You know, his whole body's full of stainless steel. He was lucky to live. It was a real serious one.
What year was that? I've got a very hazy recollection of that. Now, I don't remember it, but something's...
I've seen it. I've done... I'd left the Colne
Valley then. I reckon it was around 1990, 91.
Wow.
Something like that. You've never had Martin on your show, have you?
We haven't, no. No,
it's... That's one to get on. He's got some, you know, so he's, you know, he's one of the few old school ones left. You know, and he's the one actually I always had the most respect for in terms of the brands, you know, because he's one of the original... cart brands, the innovators, and like me, you know, just come into it just really to make a few bob to keep our fishing going, you know, before all the businessmen arrived, you know, to milk it. But yeah, I've got the stories Martin would have to tell you, you know.
Yes,
it's worth having on just to hear about rainbows, you know, and all that.
Yeah, fantastic, good shout. I do have Martin's number. I've not spoke to him for a few years. He did come to the NAS show last year, actually. I did have a chat with him. But yeah, good shout. He will be the next person that I pester for the interview. Yeah, it's, do you think? I don't know how to say this. I've got opinions on the way modern fishing is going. Modern carp fishing is going. There's people in it for lots of different reasons. Now there does seem to be some people in there for a little bit of ego. They just want to fish the lakes, you know, the accessible lakes with the big carp in. They don't really care what it costs. They want the latest tackle. They haven't done the sort of history of fishing. They've come straight into carp fishing, and it's all about, you know, using this bait company, getting a deal, catching a home fen 50 pounder or equivalent of, you know, there's plenty of waters around now where you can pay your summer money and fish for you know, large carp. Do you think we've lost a bit of that magic, that camaraderie, that, you know, everybody in the boozer on the Friday night, maybe near the lake, you know, catching up, sharing info? Do you just think, that's gone anyway, because all the info's out there now. You can get on Facebook and learn the things that you maybe had to go to a meeting to talk to like-minded people. You don't really need to do that anymore, do you, with social media? I think it's just took some of that magic away.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I just try and imagine if you went on the lake now, could you manage to have that camaraderie in the way we had it then? I think it's doubtful. Lot more people in it, obviously,
you know, because I think it's a lot smaller. That probably helped, because, you know, if you was
really keen and up there, you know, then, you know, everyone knew each other, really, you know, which is why the horse and barge worked, I guess. Less lakes, so there'd be more of a magnet for the faces to go to those. So it definitely worked better when it's a much smaller circle of anglers. Certainly it's more sociable because of that. And there's much more respect for other anglers as well, and, you know, how they
fished. You know, I always said the best year of my life, fishing-wise, not success-wise, was at Harefield. You know, the syndicate on that time was just incredible. You know, we was all mates for a year.
You know, so we actually put our own rules in place. You know, if you caught a carp during pub hours, you know, it didn't count. You know. Yeah. You expect to go to the pub, you know, and fish didn't count at that time, you know, which is where Caribbean Frogger did so well. But, it was a fantastic party year, you know, so not productive
part-wise so much, but a fantastic year of, you know, having fun with, you know, mates, you know, so I'll never regret it, you know, but, yeah, very unique times. I've never heard of any like sooner than that.
But the etiquette's a big one for me, you know. Frankly speaking, I've struggled to fish a lot of these waters now because, you know, anglers are cast across, you know, they put boats through your swims and whatever, you know, they just don't get that's not the correct thing to do, you know. Yeah.
It's, the, something that crops up a couple of times in the book, even on Warmwell, which surprised me, was there was still bitterness and jealousy even then. You mentioned a few times on the Essex Manor, which we'll come to in a minute, but Warmwell as well, where other people weren't happy with your presence, you know, for maybe different reasons on different lakes, whatever. But, you know, you felt on the Essex Manor because you caught the big one straight away, or Warmwell because, you know, that guy had booked his apartment and expected to fish right outside the front door, and you were in it. You were in the swim. I mean, there's something that I've come across on lakes, you know, if I ever write my memoirs or a book or whatever, then I don't know how to address it, because I've come across bitterness on pretty much everywhere that I've done well. And would you say that's the same with you?
Very much so. Firstly, there's a kind of defining point where attitudes and the way people acted changed, and that was clearly in the early 90s, which coincidentally coincides with when, you know, I would say people come into the sport purely to set up businesses, to earn money out of it, rather than, you know, as I said prior to that, we had fishing tackle businesses just to fund our fishing. You know, and that's why, you know, we wanted them, you know, just small scale businesses. You know, the prime concern was to go fishing. You know, and so all that changed. So that was the first defining moment when, you know, companies were set up, not necessarily by avid carp anglers even, but as I say, they saw the potential to make money. At that point, for example, as you mentioned, mainline, that's when, for the first time, I saw the issue if you wasn't on the right boat. You know, suddenly there's bait wars going on. You know, just go back a couple of years to Harefield, there was guys on Richworth, the Premier boys were there, I was there, with Catchem, it's become Nash Bait. You know, and all these people, you know, we're all mates, you know, and, you know, I can't even remember bait being referenced. I really can't. Yeah. You know, and then you go forward just two or three years, and, you know, if you weren't on, you know, the right bait, on the bait company that dominated that water, you was probably enemy number one, which, yeah, and the Manor was the first time I saw it, and it really shocked me, and as you know, I was so upset by it, I walked away from it in the end, you know. When it comes to the Warmwell, that was different. That's because of the massive growth in carp fishing, so suddenly you've got a huge number of people coming into the sport who had taken up carp fishing the day before, as it were, you know, and a completely different breed. You know, I think I said something like in the book, I'd led a sheltered life on syndicate lakes with, you know, kindred spirits and like-minded people, and so when I went on to Warmwell, you know, this holiday lake, you know, with 22 swims, only 22 biddies, guy ropes touching in each swim, you know, that was a different sort of angler. It really was a different sort of angler. I don't think I mentioned it in the book, but I remember one of the bailiffs come around, I watched him talking, having a heated debate with a guy on the other bank. He'd come round chuckling and he said, you won't believe the conversation I just had, Kevin. It was something like, you know, it's because guy said to me about this, is that Kevin Nash out there? He said, yeah. He said, well, what's he doing here? He said, what do you mean? He said, well, what's he doing here? This is a holiday lake. He went, well, what's your point? He said, well, what's Kevin Nash doing down here? This is a holiday lake. He said, he's having a holiday. You know, as if I wasn't allowed on there because I was a top carp angler, inverted commas. The top carp anglers weren't allowed to fish that lake.
Yeah.
Strange.
It's weird. I've told you this before, but I remember when I was in the band, we did holiday camps all over the place, you know, every weekend and stuff. And then we had a gig there at Warmwell. I'd heard about it, read about it in magazines. Obviously, I was a very keen carp angler there, and I believe you were on the lake. But we were, we were late arriving. Yeah, it's probably, what years were you on there? You were there early, sort of
1995, 96.
Yeah, that was my era. I was 92 to 99 in the band, 98, sorry. in that particular band, Taboo, it was called. Yeah, we had a gig there, and it was after we were late arriving, so it was, you know, stressful setting the gear up. It must have been in that restaurant. Is it? I looked on the map in the book to actually see where the club was, where we would have played in relation to the lake. Because was it where the restaurant was on your picture that backs right onto the lake?
No, there was. It's not there now. I think they've made it a shadow. There was a small restaurant on one of the islands. It was not open on a regular basis, but where you're talking about, you're up at the entrance where the main bar was, the eating area, right. And then there was quite a large seating stroke dance area and a stage. That'd be where you're talking.
Yeah, it was. We were late arriving, so we were setting up, and I wanted to go and walk round and come and find you. And I think one of the guys that I spoke to, I can't remember what he did, but somebody that worked there was an angler as well. And I remember once I got chatting about that, I realised we were on the place that had this 50 pounder swimming about. I asked the guy, oh, what's the score with the lake? I actually tried to get a summer season there, you know. So I was speaking to the guy, I said, oh, because it was a one off gig, it was the only one we ever did. I was like, oh, do you ever have like a resident band that, you know, the same band that come every Saturday or every Friday or something? Mm-hmm. So I thought if I can get a season there, I'd be able to fish it. night a week. But we were pretty late setting up, and once we'd set up, we had to pretty much go on stage, and then it was dark by the time we finished, so there was no way. I never even got a look at it, but you were fishing that night.
How's that?
Yeah, it's crazy. Sort of over 20 years ago, isn't it? Yeah, very crazy. Yes, going back to Bait Wars and the manner when you saw it, the funny thing is that I found a lot in life. You met Kev Knight on there, you know, one of the owners of Mainline, who you liked and seemed genuine, and, you know, you had a chat with him, and it was all the other people, all the field testers, all the people coming up that were doing the bitching.
Yeah, and I've seen it since, and with other bait companies, as you say, you know, it doesn't appear to be the owners of the upper echelons, they say it's the ones lower down, you know.
Yeah, they're the ones, maybe they feel like they have to be loyal, or that's where the rivalry comes from, I guess, from the minions.
I guess.
Yeah, I thought it was very odd, because, you know, I've said this all along, like, the you know, from meeting, you know, the guy that owns Nash Tackle to meeting the real person, the Kevin Nash, and speaking to you a lot and seeing the person behind the name, you know, I can't imagine you not getting on with most people, you know, if you actually meet them.
Well, I always say, Jamie, you know, like I say, you get this big thing in the tackle industry, bait industry, where, you certain company individuals snarl at the competition, and you know, I think general observation, that's because the competition is doing better than them, you know, whereas I've always had a little saying, I'll have lunch with anyone, and if they're, you know, and if they're doing better than us, that's my problem, not theirs.
It's,
you know, it's the simple philosophy of it.
Yeah, it's, you know, rivalry, competition's healthy to a degree, but we spoke about this before, especially in the tackle company. Lots of the companies, you know, the original companies, they were around, as you say, for people to find a way to go fishing more. You know, there wasn't much dedicated equipment about, and it was to try and earn a few pennies so you could stay fishing. Now, a lot of these companies are not even owned by the people that started them. You know, it's business these days, as opposed to a passion for a number of companies out there.
Well, it's coming in bigger than that, isn't it? You know, Fox is now owned by venture capitalists. You've got two angling chains. One is being floated. That's Fishing Republic, and Angling Direct has floated 40%. You know, so all the city. Kids, you know, and the fund managers, they're now all involved in it. You know, it's crazy, yeah. Whether it's good for the sport, I'm not sure at all.
What's your What's your view on these chains, Angling Direct and Fishing Republic, as you both mentioned, that seem to be trying to buy up all the shops? I mean, it's good that there's two of them, I guess, so that there's some sort of rivalry there, so it's not a monopoly, but I think it's good for the business, like these single large companies buying up all the small shops, or smaller shops.
Well, I think we're in a time of massive change, and to a degree, it's evolution. A lot of these retailers are basically at the end of their working life, either because they are getting that age, or they've been in it too long, and or they haven't reacted to modern business, and got into technology, whether it be websites or media, Facebook and all that. So there's a lot of them that, in essence, are struggling businesses. So you could kind of say it could be a positive if the chain buy them up. But on the other hand, they will never be specialists. They always be jack of all trades, master of none. They're looking for a spread of the various disciplines, whether it be from match fishing, carp fishing, to sea fishing, whatever. So they stock less in depth of any range, which, if I was out buying tackle like I used to in the 80s would be very frustrating for me. There's nowhere in Essex, for example, where I could get the experience of shopping that I'd want. But on the other hand, there's certainly room for them, and where I think they do really help the angling trade is by spreading branches all over the UK to help bring people into the sport. Then, if they get into the sport, that's where the switched on independent can really score, by being the specialist shop, stocking the brands in depth and width, making it a destination, real experience to shop there. There's a few of them around, Johnson Ross, Tackle Box, Carp Scene in Nottingham. It's just three examples, where where people will drive a long way because, they know whatever they want, it's very likely those shops will stock it. So,
I think, as I say, we've got a long way to go for this evolution, but I'm always an optimist and believe that long term it should work itself out and it'd be good for owners and all round, as I say, maybe a good spread of shops where they can get into fishing, and then hopefully there'll be enough really good independents where they can find anything they want.
Yeah, I think we're going to end up counting the independents on one hand. I think that's the, you named three of probably four or five that I can think of.
That is a worry, so again, back to your original question, when a chain does buy one of our shops, by definition, that likely means our turnover is going to drop with them, because they say they don't stop the depth and the width of the brands like the independents do, but so we'll see how it shakes out.
Yeah, you made an interesting point about the fact that a lot of people that started businesses, even companies like yourself, the manufacturers, a lot of the big shops that started when the fishing boom happened in the sort of 80s and 90s, everybody's at retirement age now, aren't they? Including yourself. It's not going to be too long, I guess, before you hand the reins over to Alan more permanently. But
Well, on that point, by the way, I hope that they're carrying me out in a wooden box.
Right.
I've got, I've made the decisions management-wise, and in essence, Alan and Lee now own the business. When I go, they get my lump, but I always hope I'll be there to back them up, and I suppose what I bring to the party is, the 40-odd years of experience. In fact, I was debating
with Sean O'Driscoll yesterday, who's managing director of DHP and Tack on Guns and all that. Am I the oldest in the industry now? I think I could be.
Right, yeah.
I've been here longer than anyone else. So that's what I really bring to the party, for Nash Tackle now, that, that depth of experience, for them to bounce off me. And of course, I'm still the one that comes up with the real quirky innovations.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no substitute for having that. But, you know, I know you're very passionate about the company still, but at some point you're going to want to sit on that, lay on that beach and not worry about it too much, I guess. But, I mean, generalising, a lot of these companies, as you said, a lot of these shops that have been going 30 years, going strong, people are wanting to settle down now. So there is change coming, isn't there, I think, in the industry?
Definitely.
Super interesting. So moving on, I mean, you finish your the Warmwell section, moving nicely into a chapter you call Mindset, but it's you start the second half of the book, you call it The Knowledge, and that's passing the information on there. I did chuckle, you mentioned the double suck, the brandy night with Roger and I. You shouted out Roger and myself that night. Now, that was, I'm going to put that interview out actually again. I know it wasn't one of the really old ones, it was only earlier this year, but it was such, it's still probably our most listened to show, that interview.
Really?
Ever. Really? Yeah, it's had over 20,000 downloads, that one, on its own. As you know, we were drinking, we did get drunk, and I edited a lot of my slurring out, but it was such an insightful interview about rigs and indication, and I'd never thought about that double suck before, and for those people who didn't hear that interview or haven't read the book yet, it was another factor of the blowback rig, which you invented on Warmwell, and it was more to, obviously, once a fish has pricked itself with a very sharp hook or whatever, they try and dislodge that hook. If the hook's coming, if the hair is coming off the shank of the hook, then they can use that to pull the hook back out once pricked by sucking and blowing again a second time. Which is kind of the thinking behind it. And then obviously when the blowback tubing blows up the eye, they cannot use it. When they suck, it's embedding the hook more as opposed to being able to.
The angle has changed. As I explained, the perfect place for a carp to suck the boilie down its throat and then, you know, pull the hook out is when it's centre bend. So, you know, so when you get it to the back of the shank, again, when they suck, the point of the hook is going to tip rather than be pulled straight out. So, but then take the anchor point right down to the eye, or with the ring, blow back with as it originally was, the ring went over the hook link. There's just no way they can get any angle using sucking the boilie to pull the hook out.
Yeah, so you think you want it round the bend of the hook to go into the mouth, and then when the fish blows, you want it around as near to the eye as possible, really, don't you? So
you want it, as you say, the anchor point as near as I used to put it, or when I tied them, I would tie them so it was at that point where just before the anchor point would go around the front part of the bend. Yeah?
Yeah.
You obviously don't want it sliding down to the hook point, but it's just the last point before it's able to, you know, slide around the front part of the bend. And then on ejection, so the ultimate is to get the anchor point below the hook knot, which you can do with a ring blow back, but so if you're using the tube, then right down to the knot. Yeah? Actually, I'll give you a little bit of news here. We're launching a new range of hooks February. Very excited because a good friend of mine, Mark Lewson, the guru of hook sharpening, Pinpoint, he's joining our company. Well, he's joined our company. So we're launching a range of Nash hooks in collaboration with Mark at Pinpoint. He's messed around, tweaked some of our old famous patterns, just really gotten more balanced on wire sizes and all that, like the twist and the thing. We've got Pinpoint sharpness, and they're incredibly sharp, but
we've managed to do it without making the points too long, because in my opinion some of these hooks coming out now, following the trend of super sharp hooks, they're too fine on the points, they'd be too easy damage for the average angler. They mean basically got to change hook every time. I think these new ones, Angler's better touch them up, but where I'm going with this, I wanted to do it for a long time. We're launching a long shank twister.
So no way.
With that one, you'll be able to get, the blowback tube further back on it. Yeah, it's going to be an absolute winner, absolute winner.
When can we see these?
We've got three new patterns coming out, actually. We've got three new patterns coming out.
I feel a little bit sick in my stomach, having used a twister exclusively now since the day you released them, which is, how long have they been on the market now? 10 years or something?
Oh, got a bit less, isn't it?
Yeah, I've used them and only them, and I'm only happy using them, so I'm a little bit... I've got trepidation.
Yeah, it's not the biggest selling car book on the market because of the marketing others, but I can tell you this, I'm absolutely convinced it's the biggest selling hook used by top carp anglers.
I need to find myself a stash just in case I don't like the new ones, but tell me there's something very similar to that.
It's Nashie you're talking to. You do not need to get a stash.
Okay.
You'll love the new twisters, you'll love the new long shank twister, and I bet you'll end up using that as much or more. And then we've got something really special as well.
Which is going to
be massive.
When are we looking at to see these on the shelves?
Early February, we reckon.
Yeah.
We've been sampling all the patterns. It was a real nervous one. We went to a new manufacturer, because everyone, the ones that I had been using all those years, couldn't satisfy a couple of things we really wanted to be innovative with. And then we found a manufacturer and went to them. But the problem with hooks is that you don't get sampled. Mm. They go straight into production on the back of your cab and everything. And then you've taken a risk and got 50,000 hooks of a size and a pattern. So it was a real nervous one. You could say it was one of the biggest gambles I've ever taken. And just like you, a lot of my boys, including Alan Blair, were saying, are you sure? I took the gamble, and sometimes you have to take a gamble, and everyone without exception is blown away by these hooks. We're using a new type of carbide alloy steel as well, so they're actually lighter than other brands hooks, which I think is another plus. So they're lighter, but get this.
Mm.
You know how strong Nash hooks are. We've tested them against other brands before, and it was between 10 and 30% stronger. But these new ones in this carbide, what is it called? 6-4-7 or something? That's it. They're up to 50% stronger than existing Nash hooks.
Which
were the strongest hooks on the market before, anyway.
Without a doubt. I mean, when we have discussions about line, there's physical limitations of nylon, and it's a trade-off, it's a compromise. If you want abrasion resistant line, it's not going to cast as well. If you want line that sinks, it's not going to cast as well. If you want a casting line, it's probably going
to
be lighter.
Just about to change that opinion as well, Jamie, because the other big news is we've got bullet back.
Ah, okay.
And I think it's better than the original. The original, I would agree, wasn't a casting line, but this new one in the 0.28s and the 0.3s is mind-blowing. Joe Hubble and Angus like that, I've sampled them and they've come back like, I've been using X line all my life, I'm going straight onto this, it's so much better. So that's the other exciting news for the spring.
I'm intrigued, very intrigued. Yeah, it sounds like some new stuff on there. In the book, you move past the rig stuff, you share a lot of the bait knowledge. One thing that was interesting, that kind of featured all the way through the book, was sweet corn.
I've always said, I'm not a salesman, I can only recommend and what I believe in. And I've always said the best carp bait ever invented, that's the wrong word, is sweet corn.
I completely agree. Roger first put me on to using a lot of sweet corn. I mean, obviously, I'd always use tins of sweet corn and fish with it on size 12 hooks for smaller carp and stuff. But when I first met Roger, sort of 15, 16 years ago, he would make a mix of 50% boily, 50% sweet corn in a cool box. He'd fill it up. I'd never seen somebody take, you know, it was cases of 24 cans. Or 12 cans if they were the bigger ones, down to the lake as standard. I'd never really sort of seen it, and I always remember it looking so good. He used to mix it up in the cool box and used to look at it in there and think, yeah, that looks really smart. And then, you know, you start off with it when you're fishing shearer in Gran Canaria. You were hunting shops down for cases of sweet corn. It kind of features in the bait section as well. I mean, you do a sweet corn extract, don't you? Is it still called sweet corn extract?
We do, and it's not only massively effective, it's massively rated. It's the biggest selling flavour in South Africa, for example.
I've always used it.
It's a bit under the radar with English anglers. You know, we've got anglers, I know anglers who use it all the time, but I guess it's due to the crap marketing that I used to do for Nash, you know, until, you know, Anne and the lads come along. But yeah, one under the radar, that, yeah, it's worth looking at that sweet corn extract. It really is.
I've kept my plastic baits in that sweet corn extract for 15 years since I first went down to Nash. I think Gary put me onto it, and because it's so pungent and strong. It's like super strong. You put your plastics in it, they're almost too strong when they come out. They absolutely stink. So I soak them for a bit and then I take them out and put them in a separate pot. And I've
you can't overload them, Jamie.
Can
you? That's one of those where do I call it a flavour extract or whatever, where you can drink it out of the bottle.
Really?
You
know,
can't be pale fish with it.
I've never asked Gary about that, actually, because it has always concerned me, because the plastics smell so strong, it has worried me. I actually think they're better after they've been out 24 hours, because they've just dulled down a bit. But you're saying that you can't ever do too much in those. That's interesting. Yeah, and it's so thick and gloopy as well. I mean, do you know anything about how that's made? I've always wondered. It's obviously made from sweet corn as opposed to, you know, a chemical mix of flavourings.
No, I don't. I've never asked Gary what's in it. I don't know, enough in my head sorting out all the tackle side.
Yeah, I think you've...
I talk about the book, don't I, about, you know, how we used to, you know, have to be chemists and make our own baits and all that, but the same now, you know, I'm just so confident in Gary, of course, you say, I've got this, I say, I'll get the basic theme of it, but, you know, I don't go into chapter and verse, you know, what's actually in all these things. I leave it to him and the considerable mind of Keith Sykes.
Yeah, yeah, they seem fantastic. Just something else I want to mention. Obviously, we don't want to give too much away in the book because it is a cracking read. But something that you've harped on about for a long, long time, and it does get a mention in here as well, is the flaking baits, the chopping baits, the crushing them up. Again, you say that you still don't really sell that much bait after buying a machine to actually smash the baits up for you. But it's such a big part of my fishing, and I know it is yours. And it's like...
As you say, if you read the book, you know, so when you read the book, it's... Crumbing baits is basically all I've been doing since the mid-90s. You know, and when I first did it in that era, you know, when I'm writing about it, which is arguably the most successful era I ever had in angling, in terms of results, but also the inventions that come out, it was such a huge edge over other anglers. And even to this day, I still believe generally it's a huge edge. You know, an angler's idea of crumbing is it's a crumble a little bit of bait out and put it in a stick or whatever, you know, whereas my idea of crumbing is the equivalent amount of bodies I will put in a swim, I'm going to do that with crumb. You know, I absolutely do believe that, you know, they will speak off the round balls as well, you know, whereas
they don't spook off a crumb. You know, it's got all the other advantages. It's taking longer to fill themselves up, so they're feeding longer to swim, and hopefully more chance of eventually if they make a mistake. And presentation over, you know, because of lightness of it, over silt or weed, you know, just a no-brainer to me. You know, I'll happily apply 2 feet kilo of crumb. Well, in the mid-90s when I did that national slideshow, I made a point of saying that slideshow, the only round ball I had in the swim was a one on me hook.
Yeah.
And I still kind of keep to that wherever I can nowadays.
Yeah, one thing that I did find interesting and wouldn't mind your thoughts on it, you spoke about obviously the sweet corn on Shearer. You took 25 kilos of boilies over with you on the plane and stuff, and you needed the sweet corn. You're more talking about virgin waters and boilies not being maybe as effective or bait selection. I mean, I remember in the 80s when I first, you know, got my hands on the Richworth ready-mades and stuff. I mean, they slayed waters that hadn't seen boilies before. So I'm a bit clouded with my memory maybe, but I remember in Terry Hearn's first book him saying about the Colmere when they discovered that in the early days, fishing for the Black Mirror, and you know, he was trying all the natural baits and the tiger nuts and other stuff, and then Laney came on and whacked a bright yellow pop up out in the middle and had a fish straight away. And like, I'm torn in two minds whether they instantly recognise boilies as food or they don't.
There's lots of things going on here. Lots of things going on here. You know, take Cheer, for example. They did not recognise boilies full stop.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, as the book depicts, from seconds of seeing sweet corn for the first time, they knew what it was. We couldn't get a take on boilies over that first 2 weeks, and we had well over 100 carp. Hence your comment was touring the island, buying up sweet corn. I think I spent 180 quid on sweet corn, and we had 25 kilos of boilies, which we couldn't get a bite.
Yeah.
In the early days, I think a lot of reasons why we struggled to get them on boilies for so long. I often found I could get fish straight on particles, but it would take longer on the boilies, 2-3 years, was because of the volume we was putting in. Now, you just mentioned Richworth. Now you're in a world where you can buy round balls on the shelf, but we was having a hand roll our bait, and, you know, looking back, we weren't hand rolling a lot. It seemed a lot at the time, but as I said, it might have been a baiting campaign, for example, it was only, you know, £5-10 a bait, you know, or a lake, you know, serious fishing. So I think there was definitely that element where, because there wasn't visually enough of these strange balls on the bottom to get the carp inquisitive, because, you know, there was plenty of other larger food sources available, that definitely happens. And I've seen recently, when I was on the big pit, that was down to richness of natural food, and so, you know, we had to use volumes of bait to switch them over from the natural food. Now, I've always said the carp is really efficient. It eats the easiest available food source in the largest quantity. You know, so, you know, you get this thing where people say, "Oh, this water's so hard because it's so rich in naturals." Well, you know, the answer is really simple. When outdo the naturals, you know, really pile the bodies in, you know, at an excessive level. And those carp will always switch to the easiest available food source. As for just wanging a single bait out, you know, breaking a bait out, well, it's a proven method, isn't it? That, you know, carp are inquisitive. And occasionally, if something's easy interesting, you know, bright yellow again, you know, sweet corn bright yellow, that they will mooch along, and if they are visually attracted by something, they might go and have a look at it and wonder what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. If somebody wants to get this book, what's the best way? Are you selling them direct through the shops, at the shows? What's the best way to get
on
it?
I've got a website called Tuna Roll Publications, and go on there and order it through the website, or they can call the office. There's a direct book line that I can't remember, which should be said at the end of the message when we get it up. So
it's finished the message, by the way, Jamie, if I get that up this week. But otherwise, they'll call the office and press 1 or 2. They can sort them out.
Adam took a load of sand and when I was in Africa, and I'm sure they'll be taking books to some of the other shows this spring. It's $39.99, including post and packing, and at the shows I think it's £35, because obviously you don't have to put the post and packing in.
And it's your goodbye to sort of writing in carp fishing, really. Is it's your memoirs, your final book?
Yeah, as you know, it comes to quite an unusual ending. I really think, I've said everything I want to say. With youngsters, a lot of what I probably say, they think, that's all old stuff, blah, 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 blah. I don't really want to be kind of seen, in that light, to keep on writing on, I'm never going to really deviate from what I've learned and, what I believe, and so I'm never going to be writing about, the latest rig that's come out, because I don't need it, or, I have different views. So I think it's best I'll retire now and let the next generation go forward with, carp fishing developments and, their thoughts.
I'm guessing you see the start of the book starts with pictures of Alan and his daughters fishing, and almost the last picture by the big common is Alan and his daughters. Is that kind of the message here? You're handing over the reins. He's the future, so energetic. He's got his daughters out with him fishing. It seems like a fitting sort of
next generation. But really, really carp fishing is a youngster's pursuit. He was talking about where he's going, all these lakes with big fishing, blah, blah. And where would I be if I was in my 30s now? For sure. Or 40s, for sure, I'd be chasing those big fish, on the waters where they were. We've all got our own thoughts on what sort of fish we want to chase, and so I'm not going to get into what counts and what doesn't, but I for sure would be on the major syndicate lakes, but I would never ever want to be on them now. So you look at all the carp anglers that are still out there after 30 or whatever years, I think it's probably a fair and reasonable to say they've all really disappeared off the carp scene. They want quieter venues where it's more about peace and not having to compete with the modern way the anglers want to fish now. It's not so much about monsters, it's more about it's about fishing for unknown fish. I'd rather fish for unknown 20s and known 50s now, but so it's different experience when you've been in the game a long time. As I say, you're looking for something really that would have been at the start of when I started carping.
Smaller fish on waters where there's less pressure or no pressure. The beautiful fish, old school, old fish, things like that. Just your values change.
And I'm not going to let you get away from it. The 82 pounder that was caught from Wingham while you're on holiday, I'm presuming you've heard about it.
I listened to your carp cast when I was on the plane, Jamie. So yeah, that's I save them for when I'm flying around, and I do know about it. So what's your question?
Should it be a record? The precedent was set with the bishop. That was a heavily spawn bound, much smaller fish that later died. Was it the Mid North Hants record?
Two fish in a row, both spawn bound.
My view on this record business is quite simple. It is
whatever species in a UK water. Simple as that.
It's the bit you just
no other rules or whatever dictate.
You know, so whether it's spawn bound or whether it's only stocked 6 months before or whatever, you know, for those people who just want to, oh, what is the biggest carp ever caught in England? They can reference that. It's a simple fact to me. It's a reference for those who just are interested in knowing what the biggest carp has ever been caught in England.
It's no way a reference to meritus, angling or whatever.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. Except, I mean, you know, if it, what about if you import a fish at £50 and then grow it to 70? I mean, that would be the biggest fish, but it isn't.
So if you bought a fish for £50 and grew it on to a record, or be gross?
Yeah. If you bought a fish from France tomorrow, £50, and dropped it in a lake, and it was £70 in a year's time, is that the biggest fish?
Say, Jay, I'm not going to try and get into any politics or issues of whether it counts or it's not or it's meritus. I think it simply should just be a record of what the biggest fish that come out of a UK water was.
I'm guessing you haven't listened to the latest podcast. It was only out a couple of days ago, and you probably haven't travelled anywhere, but the British Record Fish Committee have actually come out and made a few guidelines. When they knocked back the last home fen record, they actually kind of laid out some things that they're going to look at, and one of them is the origin of the fish. Another one is how long it's been in the lake that it's in, and how much has it of its body weight has it grown in that lake. It seems to me like they're trying to draw a line.
Yeah, I think they're just making it all so complex, and they can't even get their own act together on the rules and that. You know, so I've got no, personally, this is a personal opinion only, I've got no regard for the record list or the people who decree what's on that list. And that goes back to when Gary Bays caught the first carp from the UK over £60. Still, by the way, to this day, we're very proud that he's the only owner of a bait company to break the British record. But so Gary Bays caught the first carp over £60 from the UK. And it was never a record. The reason it was never a record, because Gary's got his skills, but filling in paperwork is not one of them. He filled in the paperwork incorrectly. I said, chucked it out. Yeah, he caught two times, for Christ's sake, in front of owners like Lee Jackson, and it wasn't accepted as a record because he messed up the paperwork.
Yeah,
and so for that very reason alone, and so all the other things, firstly we're going to make this a record, then a few years later, oh no, it doesn't count. I just have no view other than the fact it should be just a statement of, oh, if you want to know what the biggest carp ever caught in England was, here's the weight of it, black and white.
Would you sit on the Record Fish Committee board if you were asked?
No.
Okay, fair enough.
No, because size is irrelevant to me anyway. I think there's so many elements that add up to what makes a carp meritus to you. Size may be one of them, but it's absolutely not the prime one, but it certainly seems to be the one with a lot of the modern generation of anglers. I wouldn't want to sit on a record fishing meeting and really be promoting that.
Yeah, fair enough. Should we go back to, as Mark said in the podcast that he listened to, should we go back to measuring the length of them?
It's an interesting one, that, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, it's. Yeah. I think you may have held, or possibly held the record with the wood carving.
The emperor was longer, you know.
Was it? I never saw that.
The emperor was 2 inches longer than the wood carving.
Wow.
It was, just trying to think what it was, 44, 45 inches long, the emperor.
Wow.
One thing, if you did go for measurement, you end up with a lot healthier carp, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's the point.
At the end of the day, you'd beat a lot of these big carp, just obese pigs.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Well, that's enough controversy, I think. I'm not going to push you for any more. Go out and buy it. Memoirs of a Carp Fisher, Tuna Roll Publications, which is tunarollpublications.co.uk is the website. I'm sure you'll see him at the shows. Give Nash Tackle a call, and there is a number there. And as I said, you might have the sexy Sarah answering the phone very soon. Do you need me to affect those, by the way? Do you want the echo on them that I have?
How quickly can you do it, Jamie? Because, you know, so he's got the Christmas message and my book, where to get my book from. Can you turn it around in 24 hours?
I can turn it around in 20 minutes, probably.
Right, I'll email you in a minute.
Okey-doke.
Are we still on air?
We are on air, so I'll say our goodbyes and then we can
talk. Can I just say to all the listeners, have a great Christmas, guys and girls, a happy new year, and loads of chunks in it's 2018 next year, isn't it? And you, Jamie, and Rachel, and Lou, a dog, and whoever else. Is the cat there at the moment, or is that going off again?
It's, no, I've not seen it for 3 weeks.
Alright.
Happy Christmas,
have a good one, fella.
Cheers.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under the Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
So a big thank you to Kevin. Go out and buy the book, or listen to the caption. Oh. Come up with a good caption for our picture that we will get up in the next 24 hours, and you may well be able to win a copy of this book yourself. I know it's at all the shows this year, and you can get it, as Kevin says, in the interview from his publisher, tunarollpublications.co.uk. Think you're going to get a winter social in at some point, Mark? It's looking a bit grim out there at the minute, but
I might do. I'm not sure it'll involve fishing, but
yeah, I still fancy heading up to the monument. I've never fished the monument. It seems to be fishing well. They allow maggots this time of year, and I like the idea of a 36 hour session on quite a clean lake. If you know what I mean, it's the facilities are really good up there. They do 36 hour sessions, and the fish get rested once every other night. You can book it on rhfisheries.com, along with all their other fantastic lakes. Obviously, you've got the Avenue, the infamous one, which is syndicate only, which is Rob's experiment to grow very large fish. It's an absolutely cracking lake. I've seen it, but the Monument 1 and 2 are the day ticket lakes. They've just had a stocking in the Monument as well. There's another 40 fish gone in to Monument 2, with the biggest at 45, all from Rob's stocking programs and his breeding that he does up there. It's Monument 2 coming along absolutely fantastically by the look of it. The Sitch, we've got a social on there in the open access, which there are open access in the spring on there when it's closed to the normal syndicate. There's also a holiday swim on there that you can book most weeks of the year. Big double wooden swim on a platform. The lake itself is stunning. We've actually sold out our social on there now, so unfortunately there are no more places unless we have any cancellations. Obviously Acton Barnell, two fantastic lakes there, some right old history fishing there, up to £50. It's about 24-25 40s in the top lake now, in stunning surroundings. You can get open access on there in the spring, or you can apply to join the syndicate. And same with Western Park. You've seen many pictures of the carp talk, a lot of Bev and Crowy and stuff going down there catching the fantastic scaly fish. There's a boathouse that you can rent with bedroom, kitchen and everything. You can fish three swims at the side of it, or two swims, one double and one single, so you can have three people fishing. If you rent the boathouse, you can do that over weekends, or you can apply to be a member of the syndicate. All this you can do at rhfisheries.com or call the office 01952 463 141. Very much looking forward to our social on the Sitch, Mark. I can't wait for that.
It's a bit of a change of scenery for me as well.
Yeah, a good bunch of lads. The lake's very nice down there. And I'm really looking forward to that. Is that about it?
I think so. I think it's time to wrap up, move on, and be happy.
Be happy. Okay. Well, we'll be seeing you.
Simply, simply lovely.
Check out the website at www.thecapcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.